trusted, but I found your only true friend is your desire.
Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack,
Sean Chapman,
and Thomas Lack.
We're here to talk about stuff. This week on the show with special guest.
Yes, the elephant in the room.
That's me. I'm the special guest.
And the elephant in the room. He's always here. It's just we decided we'll let him speak this time.
Yes. He watches the levels usually, which is he stares at the backside of the microphone and makes sure the gain knob doesn't like move from like a, I don't know, a minor earthquake we don't sense.
It's an important rule, but yeah.
I really think people undervalue dial watchers in this community, and I just wanted to speak about that this week, which is why I'm here.
Yeah, It's a deep behind-the-scenes cut on the Weekly Stuff podcast this week.
No, Thomas is not usually here, but Thomas is my brother. If you're a longtime listener, he appears every, like, year and a half, even though I have access to him more than every year and a half. But we've been wanting to get you on the show because, let me just go over, today's show is kind of a packed one. It's also going to be a Persona-heavy one.
Yeah.
Because in the last 2 weeks since we've been off, Persona 5, the animation, debuted in Japan and also the rest of the world with the wonders of simulcasting.
Yes.
Which I just have to say, as someone who grew up collecting anime 3 episodes at a time on VHS, it's still, I know the simulcasting isn't like new, it still blows me the fuck away.
Yeah, no, I've been doing it for a while now, and it's still like every time I'm like, man, like fucking kids these days, they don't know what it was like. They don't know like having to wait for Toonami or like weird like bootleg VHSs and shit like that.
It's amazing. So we are going to talk about the show. We are going to also talk about Persona 4 Dancing All Night because, I mean, that game's a couple years old, but the sequels are about to come out in Japan.
Yes. Yeah.
And the specific reason we want Thomas on here is that last time Thomas was on the show, you were playing Persona 3.
Yes, that was, about a year and a half ago, I had just finished Persona 3 for the first time.
And you've now played 5 and 4.
I've played 5 and 4 and Dancing All Night. I have not yet played the Arena spinoffs or Q.
Yes.
Okay.
But you've played Dancing All Night, and you got, is it safe to say, obsessed with Persona 4 Dancing All Night?
I would say I got obsessed with Persona as a medium.
Okay.
And specifically Persona 4 Dancing All Night.
But
yes.
Yes. Thomas now has, in the North American leaderboards, the number one high score on every Persona 4 Dancing All Night song.
36 out of 40 songs.
Okay.
There are 4 that I have number 2 on.
Okay.
What are those 4? Can you name them off the top of your head?
Yes, there is Pursuing My True Self, the one that Teddy dances to.
Okay.
That's the only non-DLC song I have the second place on. The other ones are The Fog, Heaven featuring Hatsune Miku, and Dazzling Smile.
Okay. Yeah, those are all DLC songs.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we will get into all of this, but we're going to have just a little talk about that because I think it's kind of hilarious that we're a Persona-heavy podcast here, and it just so happens that the kind of North American champ on the rhythm game we love is sitting right here, so we might as well talk about it and celebrate some Persona music.
Yes. We just want to say congratulations, Thomas, on
Thank you so much.
And yet very impressive accomplishment.
I think that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
It is. It's definitely impressive. It's also definitely bizarre.
It's not a thing that you can go around and brag about to people,
so
it's nice to have just a little recognition here.
Yes. All right, we are also going to talk about some news. We are going to talk about some stuff. But first, let's do a quick piece of housekeeping.
Yeah.
It's midway through April, so we normally should have our next Doctor Who coming out, but we didn't have time for that yet. So that'll probably be next week.
Yes.
But the bigger piece of housekeeping we have is that I have a big life announcement that I have not really made public yet, although it got out to my family and my extended family. This week, I was accepted to a PhD. PhD as in doctor.
They're going to kick you out if you keep on mispronouncing it, Jonathan.
It's
true. They won't let you in.
I was accepted to a PhD program in film studies at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. And I haven't really talked about that on the show, but that is something I have always wanted to do. I have my bachelor's and my master's in film, and the next step would be to go on to the PhD and the doctoral program. And I'm doing that. I had been applying, and I just learned, you know, it's kind of a long application process. It's sort of like a super fucking competitive job interview.
Right.
And anyway, I finally got the final word offer, and I accepted it this week. And so it's official, and that means I will be moving, relocating to Iowa City. Why Iowa? Like, I've told this to a lot of people, they're like, Iowa has film studies? And I have to remind people, one, what I do is not filmmaking.
Right.
I might, but that's not my primary thing.
Yeah.
It's film studies, which is like, you know, you were an English major, right?
Yeah, and that does not mean I'm going around writing books. It means I know how to, like, criticize literature.
Exactly. And people understand that for English, so I'm just like, it's the same thing, but with film. And so that's what I do, and the University of Iowa actually is one of the best and most prestigious in the country. The head of my department at CU got his doctorate there, so, you know, I have it on good authority. It's a good program, and I am originally from Iowa. I was born there. Thomas was born there. We go back there every so often, so I know the area. I have a ton of family there. You know, the other option was California. And I know nobody in California.
Yeah. And so, and the price of living in most areas in California right now are horrifying. So.
Also, like, California, better weather than Iowa, no doubt.
Sure.
Overall, I would still probably rather live in Iowa.
Yeah. I think it would be hard for me to live any place that never snows. I think that would be a hard thing to get used to.
Because even if you're, it's, like, not your favorite thing in the world, it's just you're so fucking used to it.
I think it would make me very paranoid if it never snowed. It's like, yeah. I've lived in Colorado my whole life, and if I just, like, went several years with no snowing, I would lose my mind, slowly but surely.
Well, if you want to visit me in Iowa, there's a good a period of the year where it will definitely be snowing.
Yeah.
But anyway.
And when it's not snowing, it'll just be completely frozen over, and you might break your leg again.
Yeah, I broke my leg in Iowa once. Anyway.
Congratulations, though.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, thank you.
Congratulations on recovering from the broken leg, finally.
Yes.
And now being emboldened enough to return to the site of your trauma.
It's been a tough 10 years for you.
So, Sean, this is a question we've had to ask on the podcast before at different life events. Does this mean the Weekly Stuff podcast is ending?
Never!
Never.
Never. Not until we're both dead.
Never.
Okay. Yes.
Yes, Thomas will make sure.
Yeah.
From the background, I will ensure...
It'll be the spin-off where Thomas reviews all the Persona soundtracks one track at a time.
I won't talk about it.
Anyway, but yes, we will keep doing it. It's just that for a time at least, this show will turn into a remote recorded podcast, which if you listen to podcasts, my understanding is that's most of them.
Yes, it's a very common thing these days. So yes. It's not some, you know, we don't have to like send telegrams to each other and like construct a podcast that way.
No, I will miss recording directly in the same room with you, Sean.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, I will not be gone 100% of the year.
Yes, it's Iowa. It's not
an
insurmountable distance.
No. So we will still figure it out. Obviously, we weren't shutting down the show when there's a new Doctor Who coming.
Yeah, I think that would be criminal.
That would be very criminal. We have to. Like, I don't know how I would process Doctor Who at this point without this show.
It is a codependency thing at this point.
Yes. Not between you and me. Between us and
Doctor Who.
And a British television show we have no say in.
Yes. That's what I think.
Yeah. So anyway, it will continue. There will be a shift. I would expect some interruption in the show this summer as I prepare for that move. But who knows? Maybe we'll just bank up some episodes on... We still have some Star Wars shows to do.
Yeah.
You know, we might just start saving those for when we have some gap weeks. But yeah, it's exciting. It'll be happening. And, you know, hopefully I'll have new cool things to share with you guys too. Because if I'm going back to film school, y'all know what that means.
Yes.
I'm going to have new weird shit to tell you about.
Yeah, we'll get to like do a sequel to the episode where you went through your like top 10 weirdest film school movies you saw.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That's the list I can only really tell my family members about like the top 2 or 3, like 10, 9, and 8. Yeah. And then I kind of have to cut it off. But yeah, that's still one of my favorite episodes we've done. So yeah, so this is obviously a big dream of mine that is coming true and I'm getting to do. But our first thing on stuff, Sean, last time you and I were together, so 2 weeks ago when we last recorded, after we were off the air, we were talking about anime and some different stuff, and you encouraged me to get into a much, much more inconsequential dream of mine.
Okay.
And undertake that dream. Not just the most inconsequential dream I have. Which is, since I was a kid, I've wanted to watch the Yu-Gi-Oh! Anime, Yu-Gi-Oh! Duel Monsters, okay. in its original Japanese.
I legitimately did not know where this was going when you started talking. So.
That's how inconsequential it is.
Very inconsequential.
But we were talking about how I finally like had a Crunchyroll subscription because we've been watching the Persona stuff.
Yeah.
And Yu-Gi-Oh! Duel Monsters, which is the name of the original like 224 episode Yu-Gi-Oh! Anime that everyone over here knows, they've been uploading in Japanese on there for the past, like, 3 years. They're doing, like, two a week for whatever reason. I don't know if they have to subtitle it or it's right. just the rights holders want it doled out slowly. But, and I had known it was going up, but at the beginning it's like, well, I'm not going to do it, like, an episode at a time, you know, because they're almost putting it out in, like, real time, you know. But I was a big, big Yu-Gi-Oh! Fan as a kid, and when I say, like that doesn't express it enough.
Right.
That was, like, I think the way 80s kids talk about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which I will never understand, I can understand through the lens of my obsession with Yu-Gi-Oh! As a child.
Yeah.
Because I was in deep.
We all were at some point. I was a fan of the Yu-Gi-Oh! As
yes.
well.
But, you know, as the years went on, you started to realize, hey, this dub thing is kind of weird. Why are all these Japanese characters talking with Brooklyn accents?
Yeah, why is everybody, like, all these, like, henchmen holding out these, like, open-palmed hands and it seems like, you can't threaten me with that. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, so obviously the Yu-Gi-Oh! Dub was famously, I don't know if censored is the right word, but, you know, edited by 4Kids Entertainment.
Yeah.
Kind of like the Pokemon anime or something. It's not as noticeable on Pokemon, obviously.
It happened to Digimon as well.
Happened to Digimon. A lot of shows back in the day. Happened to One Piece for about 6 months, and then someone realized, okay, this is the line.
Yeah.
You're not doing this to 1,000 episodes of anime. That's impossible.
Yeah.
One Piece did not have 1,000 episodes yet, but it had at least 500.
They saw into the abyss, and they knew that it couldn't continue.
No.
The abyss of One Piece.
But Yu-Gi-Oh! Is actually a much more interesting series than I actually think people in the pop culture today kind of give it credit for, especially if you've read the original manga by Kazuki Takahashi, which is just an awesome manga, especially the first 7 volumes before the game Duel Monsters is really introduced in the form we would come to know it as.
Which Duel Monsters is like the Yu-Gi-Oh! Card game. Like that's what that became.
Yeah, originally called Magic and Wizards, like had a very different, lamer name. But in the manga, like it starts out super dark. It's all about this little kid, Yugi Muto. And that's the other thing. I don't understand why they did this, that he's Yugi Moto in English and Muto. That's just the weirdest fucking change of all of them.
I mean, especially because with the way they handle the rest of the name changes, he should have been like Yugi Jackson or something.
Yugi Jackson, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yes, so in the early one, you know, Yugi Muto is this like shy little kid who doesn't have any friends, and he completes the Millennium Puzzle, and he becomes Yu-Gi-Oh, the King of Games, who is this super dark serial killer motherfucker.
Yeah, he's just a straight up murderer at some point.
Who just like will take on Yugi's bullies and bad people in the community, and sometimes not that bad people in the community, like someone who's trying to swindle people for like $5 or something, and he will play murder games with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, he mellows out over the course of the 40 volumes of the manga, although even in the TV adaptation, like, versus those manga scenes, they have mellowed him out further, even in the Japanese. But the manga is really interesting, and Takahashi just was a guy who was super into different kinds of, like, non-video game games. There's a whole arc in the manga where Bakura, as they call him in English, is introduced, and they play basically Dungeons and Dragons sort of thing, and that's my favorite arc of Yu-Gi-Oh! And it's volume 6 and 7 of the manga, if you're interested. But the manga is great, and the manga made me want to see the show in Japanese. But, as we were talking about earlier, back in the mid-2000s, it was really hard to see anime in its native language.
Oh, yeah.
You either had DVDs 3 at a time subtitled, if the show was popular enough, like a Dragon Ball, or you had, maybe you could download fan subs, but the internet wasn't that good back then, or you could find maybe fan sub bootlegs, right? Yeah. And so all of these were really difficult options. And then I remember, I had to look up the years for this. It was 2005. 4Kids partnered with Funimation and briefly started doing a line of Yu-Gi-Oh! Uncut DVDs where they had it in Japanese, original footage, original soundtrack. They redid the dub. It still had like the name changes and stuff, but was more accurate. And they had subtitles and all that, and it was great. And it lasted for 3 volumes and 9 episodes, and then was canceled. And that's all I've ever seen of Yu-Gi-Oh! In Japanese, was 9 episodes.
Basically 22-minute long episodes.
Yes. And that was the year 2005, and Crunchyroll didn't get the rights until 2015, because Yu-Gi-Oh! The anime is not made by one of the companies you guys know, like Toei or Toho or something. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't even air on like one of the anime networks like you know TV Tokyo or something that you see Dragon Ball on or something, right? So like it's just a little. The rights are very different. The actor who plays Yugi in the series and the you know Yami Yugi, the Dark Yugi, is not a seiyu by trade. He's a singer, and so like he exerts a certain rights influence on where the show gets distributed because he has a different kind of contract than normal anime voice actors. And so it took forever to get through the red tape of someone having the influence to get this fucking show out. And finally, Crunchyroll did it, only after they'd had Yu-Gi-Oh! GX in Japanese for years. As like a test case, you know? But it's finally on Crunchyroll. And Sean, since we last recorded, I have watched 45 episodes.
Good God.
Yeah.
Good. That's 2 weeks. 2 weeks. Uh-huh. And when did you start?
Monday. Recorded Sunday. I started Monday. And I should say, I've slowed down a little bit because I got to episode 40 by the next Monday.
Okay.
The 40 were in 1 week.
So it was a Fast and Furious week of Yu-Gi-Oh! is what you're saying.
It was because here's something you reminded me of. This is what made me follow my dreams. Is that shonen anime is like candy. It's 22 minutes. You just pick one up. And you're like, that was good. I'm going to do another one. And before you know it, you've watched 40 episodes of Yu-Gi-Oh! In a week.
And you're sending your brother clips of Pegasus swearing in Japanese.
Oh, I gotta play this for you guys. This fucking... Let me see if I can... No, it's not in here. Let me see if I can find it. I'm gonna pause the podcast for a second.
Okay.
Okay, so, the thing to say is just Yu-Gi-Oh! Is a really good anime. Like, if you've only seen the dub, at least give the Japanese version of the anime, like, on Crunchyroll a chance. It's so much fun. It's so well done. The voice acting is just outstanding. It's one of those dubs where, especially if you know the manga, the source material, it's really rewarding to see that they, like, perfectly cast the show. Mm-hmm. Kind of like, you know, Dragon Ball or something, where you're like, I can't imagine anyone else playing these characters. If I were to recommend one, like, episode or story arc to you, because I've seen the whole Duelist Kingdom arc. It's the first season, basically, which is where they're on the island. It's basically Battle Royale, but with card games.
Yes, 100 card, like, duelers land on an island, and then they fight until one of them survives.
Yes, that's pretty much it. I realized that this time, and I'm like, huh, that's... I mean, there's no real violence or stakes to this thing, but interesting.
Yeah, I think Konami has the rights to Yu-Gi-Oh, right? For the games, so it's like, there you go, Konami. That's a free idea.
Free idea.
Take it up. You're not doing anything else.
Player Unknown's Duel Monsters.
Exactly.
Anyway, but yeah, it's such a fun show, and if I were to recommend one, like, story, there is the story near the end of that arc where Kaiba, who is the best Yu-Gi-Oh! Character we all know.
Yes, he's super cool. He's got a long jacket. Jackets are cool.
He's the Vegeta of Yu-Gi-Oh!
Yes.
In that he's their enemy, but also their friend.
He's too cool to be evil.
Yes, exactly. And Kaiba in the Duelist Kingdom arc, his little brother Mokuba, it has been kidnapped by Pegasus, the villain. The other weirdest change to the dub, by the way, is that his name in Japanese is Pegasus J. Crawford. Uh-huh. And in English, it's Maximilian Pegasus.
Yeah.
It was already an American name. And that's just one of those where it's like, it's not a bad change. It doesn't hurt anything. I just don't get it.
Yeah.
Like, I'd love to hear the reasoning behind that.
It's just like, you know, it's Maximilian's a cool name.
It is, definitely. But Pegasus has kidnapped Mokuba's soul and body, I guess. And so Kaiba's like, got to get into the castle. And the only way he can do that is by fighting Yugi. And so it's the three-parter where Kaiba and Yugi duel, which culminates in Kaiba threatening to kill himself if Yugi attacks him. And just the voice acting in that episode, if you've ever wanted to hear what a Yakuza movie would be like if it were about card games, it's those episodes. And it is fucking amazing. And because also, like, it's more in the dub, I think I remember the whole thing is that Kaiba is standing on the ledge and he's like, the blast from my hologram will knock me off, Yugi. And in Japanese, it's just, no, if you do it, I will jump. So, and I can't really tell which one is darker.
Yeah.
But anyway.
I think the suicide one is darker.
Yeah, I think Kaiba's just saying, like, no, motherfucker.
I'll jump.
Like, that's like, you know, like the nightmare relationship. It's just like, no, like, you can't leave me. I will kill myself, Yugi.
We
need this.
It's pretty great. But that whole arc is fantastic. It's one of my favorite stretches of that show or the manga. And the villain is, as I said, Pegasus J. Crawford, who is the weirdest voice in the show because he's an American character, played by a Japanese guy, obviously, who talks in, like, really, like, formal Japanese. Like, every sentence is, you know, des at the end, that kind of thing. But he also, like, there's no other way to say this because this is the coding for the character in Japanese culture. He's flaming. He is very, very effeminate, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, anime of the period does that.
The anime now. Does like, that. That's, you know, Japan, Pegasus, and LGBT, it's a thing.
Pegasus is the one character they toned down in the dub. I'll just put it that way.
Just fucking saying something if you see the dub of that shit. Not toned down that
I'm going to play you 9 seconds, though.
Okay.
Of a clip from the final battle between Yugi and Pegasus. Final card game.
Okay.
Where Yugi starts turning the tables and Pegasus is losing his shit and he starts swearing in English.
Oh, good.
This is... You guys are going to love this.
This is a treat. Goddamn!
Goddamn! It's the best! I love it! I watched that clip so many times when I got to that episode.
There is nothing better than Japanese people cussing in English. It is the best. It's just the best thing.
It's the best. And there's another part where he goes like, shit! Motherfucker! Not motherfucker, but it's like something like that.
Fuck!
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so good.
You loved this so much that I work nights, and at like 1 in the morning, you texted that clip to me, and because you sent it over text, it was super pixelated, and you had to explain to me what it was. Because
you couldn't see or hear it.
I couldn't see or hear it. And through that whole exchange, you were just really excited about how Pegasus was swearing in English.
It's good. Because they build up to it for 40 episodes. It's
God
good.
Damn.
Also, the music in Yu-Gi-Oh! Duel Monsters is up there with the best anime music I've heard. And that's something I remember from when I saw the 9 episodes on DVD in 2005, is, you know, 4Kids did a complete soundtrack replacement, as they were wont to do back then.
Same thing with Digimon, which is fucking a tragedy when I ended up watching some original Digimon. It's like, oh my god, the music was really good. It wasn't this horrible, like, weird... like techno rap bullshit we got stuck with over here.
Or like Dragon Ball with the rock music and stuff. But yeah, so anyway, but the music in the Japanese is just, it's awesome. It's one of those things where they have like that one theme for characters turning the tables.
Yeah.
And whenever they play it, you get pumped. Yes. It's like in the Rocky movies, it's like, these are so silly at this point. It's Rocky V, he's fighting on the streets, but they're playing the theme and I'm into it now.
Yeah.
You know, it's the good shit. So anyway, that's what I've been doing for 2 weeks.
Okay.
Yu-Gi-Oh! It's fun, and I'm, anyway, I'm glad I followed this dream.
I'm glad for you, Jonathan. It's what we're here to do, is to live our dreams.
I'm glad that you were watching Yu-Gi-Oh! When you found out about this great PhD news.
I did. I was watching.
I think that makes the whole thing more significant for you.
Don't tell them that, Jonathan. Don't tell them that. They won't let you go.
My emphasis is in Japanese film and animation. It's technically within, you know.
Like, fucking Jesus.
So this
Christ.
Is all academic as well.
Yeah, I've signed...
Just to keep on telling yourself that. That's what I've been telling myself for years.
My dissertation on Yu-Gi-Oh! And the art of card games.
Yes, Yu-Gi-Oh! And like, the lost decade of Japan's economy.
Yes. Yu-Gi-Oh!
My grand theory.
This is the other thing. I guess I always knew this in the back of my head, but I didn't see it until presented with the evidence. Yu-Gi-Oh! Is Japan's Star Trek. It has had a spinoff on the air every fucking week since the year 2000. Because they did Duel Monsters, GX, whatever was after that. They did the thing with the motorcycles. There is one still airing right now that is simulcast on Crunchyroll.
Yeah.
Yu-Gi-Oh! Will never end.
It's
I mean, if you add it all up, it's One Piece length. I mean, it's been going that long, which is scary.
It is horrifying.
Because nothing should be One Piece length.
Yes, especially not One Piece. It's too much. It's too much. It's terrifying.
All right, Sean, do you want to talk about what you've been up to?
Yes, so what I have been up to is a continuation from our last podcast. I've been playing and have finished Far Cry 5. I actually finished Far Cry 5 earlier today. I had kind of gotten up to the point where I could have finished it and just was kind of dawdling around, running around in the open world and realized, oh, we're recording the podcast today. I might as well finish it and just went to the... Because as I was saying on last week's, or 2 weeks ago on the podcast, the structure of that game is... The game is sort of split into thirds with a major boss governing each of those areas. And once you clear them out, it's just like, go to the middle island and do the last boss fight. Like, there isn't even a, like, process to it. It's literally like, just drive up to the spot where the game started, walk up to the church. The bad guy is there. Joseph, I think it's Joseph Seed. There's John Seed, Jacob Seed, and Joseph Seed. And then Faith Seed is a little bit easier to pick out.
And John Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt Seed.
Yes, that's the DLC. Okay. When you go to Mars. which is actually one of the things on the DLC I think that they've said on the road.
What?
That's because they don't. They don't give a shit. It's Far Cry. They don't give a shit. You know. But yeah, you just walk up to Joseph Seed, and he's like, "Hey," and he just gives you this fucking speech like it's ripped out of some like fucking first person shooter from 2009 about like, man, you can't solve every problem with a bullet. Man, like, you just, like, who's the real monster here, man? Like, I'm trying to build something and all you do is destroy. It's like, he just gives you that speech, and then you get to make one of two choices, which is basically, do you want the quote-unquote good ending, or do you want the quote-unquote bad ending? There is no actual good ending to this game. And I'm just going to spoil the ending,
because I want to hear it.
Yeah, and nobody should give a shit. The ending of the game is, like I said, you encounter him, he gives you this choice, for the fucking speech, like, everything about the story of this game is just ripped from that period, like, before first-person shooters generally learned how to give a shit in telling a story, where it's just, like, the game pretending, like, oh, you're the real monster because you've been killing all these people. It's like, dude, what other choice do I have? Like, I have fucking, like, one option in this game is walk around and shoot people in the face. There's no, like, more, this isn't fucking Mass Effect. You know, it's not some RPG. I don't have, like, it's not Dishonored. I can't just go around and knock people out and, like, throw them in the back. Like, I have to fucking just murder every single person I run into. I try to melee take someone down. I don't choke them out and leave them in the bush. I knock their fucking brains in with an aluminum baseball bat. Like, that's my option, right? So it's just really exhausting to have this villain lecture at me for 5 fucking minutes about how I'm the real monster and this dude who has organized this death cult and took over an entire county in Montana and is murdering, like, regular civilians on the regular, that I'm fucking finding, like, the dead bodies of people, like, fucking strewn up, corpses strewn up on the cliffs. Apparently I'm the real fucking monster. He gives you that full speech. Then you have a choice to either, like, it's like, let well enough alone and just say, like, ah, fuck it, and leave, which is not the choice I made, because it's like, I'm not going to find the last... It's like Mario strolling up to Bowser in the last castle where, like, Peach is kidnapped and just being like, and Bowser being like, you know what, Mario? You sure killed a bunch of Goombas, and Mario being, that's a good point, I'm just gonna leave. Like, fine. Like, see ya, and then the game's over, and I watched that ending in that on YouTube, and basically what happens is you get in the car with your sheriff buddy and everybody else, and you just drive off, and then there's, like, a brief, like, hint that, oh, you've been brainwashed and you're gonna murder all those people. It's fucking stupid. But the other ending you get if you say, no, I've played this video game, I'm going to fight the last boss of this video game, why are you stupid, is you fight a pretty dull last boss, but it's a first-person shooter. Like, you're not playing a game like this to fight, like, a big cool boss at the end. You know, it's not Doom. It's not going to, like, surprise you in any way. But you do that last boss. I did kill him by just throwing C4 into his face. It stuck to his face, and I detonated it, and that was a very satisfying way to kill him. Unfortunately, the next cutscene didn't open with his body parts just strewn across the whole area, as it should have been. It was just, like, you know, normal cutscene. What happens in that cutscene, though, is the guy is still just going on about, like, you haven't been paying attention, man, like, fucking, like, the world out there has gone crazy, and I'm trying to, like, save as many people as I can. And then in the background, a nuclear bomb goes off. At the end of this game, Montana gets nuked from somebody. I don't know. Presumably, I guess North Korea. I think there's something about, and if you, like, listen to the radio in the car, sometimes you will hear news bulletins. I heard that that was a thing, and I was all, like, I drove cars all the time in this game and constantly had the radio on. I never heard a fucking one. Apparently, there's something in the radio that sets up the idea that there's going to be, a thermonuclear fucking encounter that apparently they nuked Montana. Don't know why, if you're going to nuke America, Montana's about, like, the last, like, you want to nuke, like, New York, you want to nuke fucking, like, you know, Virginia or Washington, like, you want to nuke somewhere that's, like, you're going to take out one of our key military, like, strongholds, right? Not Montana.
I thought it would at least be, like, the states did it to itself to, like, get rid of the death cult or something.
Well, there's not, I mean, that's entirely possible. There's fucking no explanation. There's no, okay. Like, there's literally no piece of exposition that describes how the situation with the nuke occurs. The nuke just goes off. And it is entirely possible, this isn't my interpretation of the game, but there's enough, like, drug bullshit and, like, hallucination bullshit that happens over the course of the story, which is a very Far Cry thing, and they kind of take it to 11 with this game. It's possible that that whole thing, the situation is hallucination, it's not really presented that way.
But that's just the end of the game?
Well, no. The nuke goes off. You are like, you and all your posse of buddies are like, well, let's take this guy and throw him in the van. I'm like, just shoot him in the head and leave. Like, fucking, why are we bothering, taking this asshole into custody when I've murdered every other single person? I've never taken one person alive. What is the point now of taking this dude into custody when we just saw a fucking nuke go off? Just kill him and, leave. Why are we taking him alive in the van? You obviously don't have a choice. I don't get to be the real monster that I want to be in this moment. So you throw him in the van. You drive to the bunker where your buddy, I don't even remember his name, Bruce or some shit. There's some guy who, at the beginning of the game, saves you, and he's some prepper with, a doomsday stronghold. Like, John Goodman in 21 Cloverfield Lane is basically what that character felt like to me. But you're not supposed to be scared of him, even though it's this dude's probably fucking crazy. But they never, kind of get into that. And you go to his bunker, and right when you get there, and this part of the game is actually kind of impressive of the, fire just sweeping through the landscape and, huge, plumes of smoke blowing through your way and trees falling in front of you. It's technically impressive what they do with the destruction around you as you're, racing in the car to get back to this bunker. But then once you get there, a scripted sequence happens where a tree knocks your car over, and then you're basically knocked unconscious. Everybody else in the car is dead, except for Joseph Seed, who is somehow fucking alive and totally fine, despite having C4 blown up in his face. Grabs your character, drags you, and pulls you into the bunker. You regain consciousness, see that he killed Dutch, I think his name is. You see he killed Dutch, and then he just sits there and is like, I could kill you, but there would be no point, because everybody else is probably dead. And then he just leans back in his chair and looks at you, and then the game goes to credits. And the game goes to credits for, an hour, because it's a Ubisoft game, and so 5,000 people worked on it. And that's the end of the game.
Man, I wish we had, a camera on my face while you were describing that, because I facepalmed a couple times, and I'm sitting here kind of stunned. Wow. Here's the thing. If this game had, from what I've heard, things to actually say, that could be an interesting ending in some ways.
It's an interesting idea for an ending if this was, Doctor Strangelove.
Sure,
which
yeah.
Which I think is, it's the thing about this game is it feels like it has these, two tones it cannot fucking figure out. It's like the anti-Wolfenstein 2, where it's Wolfenstein 2 has this, pulpy, absurd comedy to it, and also, this really, intense, soulful drama to it, and it fucking weaves between those two masterfully. This is, has fucking GTA America, quote-unquote, satire. It's hard to tell where it's satirical and where it's not. I give them the credit, the benefit of the doubt, that they're trying to be satirical, because they're clearly trying to do something with it. But trying to be funny in one end, and then on the other end, it's, like I said, you're seeing, bodies of, innocent people strung up on fucking cliff sides with, heretic written in blood on the side, and, hearing about some dude, eating people alive who works for the cult. Which, again, I'm the real monster, not the guy who hires the guy who throws people in pots and eats them alive. So it's incredibly dark, incredibly violent, incredibly gruesome, and it's trying to do that and then also be satirical and funny and end with a fucking nuclear explosion. It's but does nothing to try to bridge those two tones. Not even an attempt at it, not even a Hail Mary, just nothing. It can't figure that out at all, which is infuriating because, again, when you're just in the open world playing the game, it's a tremendous amount of fun. And it's especially once you get near the end and you have a bunch of the weapons unlocked and a bunch of the skills, and I have my bear Cheeseburger with me and my cougar buddy Peaches with me, and me and Cheeseburger and Peaches are just going around wasting the fucking the landside of Montana, murdering as we go.
Do you get to name them, or those?
No, that's their name.
Oh.
Okay, that is wonderful. The game gets points for those names.
Oh, absolutely. And when it's and that's where it's when it's just you on your own making your own fun, they give you the tools to have fun with, and specifically with those tools being a bear named Cheeseburger, who has a collar with pictures of cheeseburgers on them, who is from a, zoo, and his, habitat enclosure that, he sleeps in the zoo is a gigantic plastic cheeseburger. That's awesome. That shit's great. When I'm just, exploring around and stumbling upon, weird cabins. And one of my favorite things about the game is that the vast majority, probably like 80 to 90% of the buildings in the game you can go into, and they're like fully modeled interiors and they're unique looking. Like, all of that stuff is fucking awesome, and the game is gorgeous. It's got great music. It's got some of the best, like, maybe my favorite pause menu music since like a Persona game or something like that. It's really great. That stuff's so good. And then every once in a while you hit like the story mode mission point where it will literally just yank you out of whatever you're doing. This is probably the most infuriating design decision I've seen in the game in a long time, is that once you, you know, while you're clearing out one of those main mission, like big areas where the three bosses are, you, every single mission you do and activity you do racks up points on this meter. And then once you get to like a third of the way through the meter, it hits this like pip that like triggers like, okay, story thing is going to happen. And there's one at two thirds. And then obviously there's the last one for you taking out the boss. And in all three areas, every single one of those pips, when you trigger them, they send out a squad that, like, basically you are invincible for all intents and purposes. You can kill them, but they will just keep on coming at you infinitely. And then eventually they will knock you out and then drag you to someplace where the villain will, like, fucking soliloquy at you for, like, 10 minutes. Just, like, awfully. And then you have to do some terrible mission and you're, like, halfway across the world from where you were. And it just yanks you out of the open world. It's something where if you could mod this game to take out every single bit of the main story, it would be a much better game. I would have enjoyed it a lot more. Hopefully on the PC, that people, like you have enough access to the game that you can just do that. Because I would 100% recommend playing this game if you could just take out all the story stuff.
It's so, three thoughts.
Yeah.
First, the nuclear bomb thing. I just, one last reaction.
Yeah.
Here's how I imagine this whole thing went, Sean, is that the guys at Ubisoft were sitting around, like, a story meeting, like, I don't know how to end this game, guys. And then they go off and they're like, they have lunch, and one guy sits down at his PS4, and he's playing Modern Warfare Remastered with the Infinite Warfare thing that came out a couple years ago. He's never played it. And he gets to the nuke thing, and he's like, that was so cool.
Yeah.
I bet no one has copied this. Let's do it. And that's where it came from.
Yes.
Second thought. I really hope the next Doom game, which is now rumored, we're going to hear about it at E3.
Yes, I'm very excited. Doom 2 Hell on Earth, please. Just give it the same subtitle and everything.
Yes. Doom 2 Hell on Earth 2018.
Yeah.
I hope that game ends with the Doom Marine like getting to the final boss, and that boss starts monologuing about, who's the real monster? I'm a demon, but you've been killing all the... And then the Doom guy just punches his throat out.
Yes!
That's how that game should
100% end. 100%, that's what I felt like playing this game of, like, this is the shit that Doom was making fun of from that era of first-person shooters that thought they were telling an interesting story, but weren't, and, like, couldn't figure it the fuck out. That's what it felt like. This whole game was like Doom if it wasn't trying to be, like, if it wasn't taking the piss out of what it was making fun of at every turn.
Third thought, I kind of want to play this game. And it's a weird thing because I really have never had any interest in the Far Cry games. And I also, like, I have a pretty low threshold where, like, I can't play a game I don't like or think is bad. It's just... It's kind of like a book. Like I can watch a bad movie because it's 2 hours.
Yeah.
But, like, if I am marginally not into a game or TV show or book or something, I just can't stick with it. And yet, this game sounds so fascinating in what is good and bad about it. Kind of is like a critical exercise. Yeah. I would like to play it. So I might have to at some point.
Yeah, like, I'm trying to eviscerate the story here because I think it's terrible. Like, I did enjoy my time with it because, again, like, the vast majority of your time spent with the game is the fun part of it. It's like when it yanks you out, that's almost like makes it that much more frustrating because it's like, this stuff is so bad. And what I was doing when I was like fucking flying around in my ridiculous plane and jumping out with that, I put like C4 on and jumping out of it and crashing it into an outpost, and I'm fucking floating down on a parachute and blowing up the C4 I had on it. That's so much fucking fun that when they yank you out of that and make you do something stupid, and like by something stupid I mean sit in a chair and have a like very poorly constructed character rant at you forever. Like, that stuff's so awful that it, like, the contrast makes it seem even worse. But it is a really interesting game from, like, an academic point of view, and I'm glad I played it for that much. Like, I'm not saying that you need to play it for that. I would still recommend playing Far Cry 4, because I think Far Cry 4 is an interesting game and a better game in most regards.
Also, here's a benefit, a cheaper game.
And a cheaper game.
If I wanted to play Far Cry, I probably should just play 4.
Yes, but that would be the one I'd recommend. Before we move on from Far Cry 5, the last note I want to leave on, as almost like a weird combination of this, all the weird stuff with this game that's like both really like kind of baffling decision, but also this is the by far the funniest thing in the game. I can't believe they left this in. Thinking of what you're saying about the Doom Marine. You can't do this during those big scripted cutscenes, but when you're going around the open world and you run into like a person that can give you side missions or stuff like that, you go up and talk to them and you enter what like almost feels like, you know, what happens when you talk to someone in Skyrim, where like the camera kind of pans over like in this like very like, okay, you're in conversation mode, but like in Skyrim, the rest of everything else is going on in the world. And some hilarious shit can happen with that of like, you know, a bear will like kind of like come out of the brush and attack the person you're talking to as you're talking to them because the rest of the world's going on. The way that dragons could like, you know, attack towns and shit when you're talking to a guard in Skyrim. It has that, and that is funny every time that happens, no matter what the game is. The thing they did in this that like takes it a step further that is so ridiculous they put this in is that when you're talking to someone, you put all of your weapons away. And you go into, basically, you equip your fists. And so you have, like, your fists are, like, a separate equipable melee weapon that you can also put, like, baseball bats and stuff like that, melee weapons you find in the environment, into that slot. But you automatically equip your fists, and it does not disable your attack. So, but in the way that it pans your camera so that you're looking right at their face means that, and I never really did this on purpose because I never needed to, but you know how, like, sensitive the triggers can be on the PS4 controller and stuff that. That, like, sometimes, you know, I'm playing the game, I'm talking to someone who's going to give me a side mission, like, oh, I'm going to, like, put my controller down over here and, like, pick up my Coke and take a sip of my Coke, and I set the controller down, and it just, like, very lightly depresses the trigger, the R2 trigger, and my guy just, flat, just, like, full on right, like, straight into the person's face, just punches them right in the fucking face while they're trying to give me quest dialogue, and like, what the fuck? And they like duck down and freak out. I'm like, oh geez, I'm sorry. And you have to wait like a minute for them to like calm down and collect themselves. And then you talk to them again, and it does the thing that like Grand Theft Auto 5 did, where if you're like, so a character was interrupted while they were like giving important dialogue, and when it re-triggers that dialogue, they go like, there's this canned line where it's like, so anyways, where was I? You need to go to this water treatment plant. It's just like, I just fucking broke your nose, dude. Like, this is a bizarre interaction. I belted like 15 people in this game. But they're like 15 innocent, nice people trying to give me mission dialogue. And the most cruel thing about the game is that I did that to like 15 people on accident. And the one person I wanted to do that to, Joseph fucking Seed, I couldn't. Like, it was a canned cutscene. You can't just pop him right in the nose when he's trying to give you this big dramatic speech. That is the thing that other developers or like Ubisoft should take from this, a lesson from Far Cry 5 for the future. If you're going to have an obnoxious, terrible story with obnoxious, terrible characters, allow you to punch them in the face while they're talking. That is a valuable lesson.
It'd be great. It wouldn't even have to interrupt the gameplay. Just
pop right in the face.
That is the only thing you've said about the game that's made me kind of want to play it.
Yeah.
I'm sad you can't do it to the annoying people, though.
Yeah, you can't do it to the people that deserve it. But it is still funny when you do it to the people. It's especially funny when you do it on accident, because it surprised me every single time, because I constantly forgot that you could do it. And I was not expecting to, like set the controller down. I'm going to go to the bathroom, set the controller down, stand up, look, it's like the person's like crying on the ground because they just punched him in the face. Ah, God damn it. I'm both upset at myself and laughing.
So, Thomas, do you have any stuff?
Yeah, what's happened to you in the past year and a half? In excruciating detail.
Oh, boy.
You graduated college.
I did graduate college, yeah.
Let's not happened. Go back that far.
No, that's okay.
Have you played any... You played Final Fantasy XV on PC.
I did. That was actually... I was surprised because I haven't played that game since... Basically, since it came out. I think I played it December, the year it came out, on Xbox. Yeah. Which, looking back, is definitely the worst way to have played that game. Because on PS4, I don't think it looked great either. The thing that bugged me about the graphics was the hair was, like, super aliased.
Yes,
and
yeah.
Every character has that, you know, sort of Kingdom Hearts, Final Fantasy, really sharp hair.
Yeah, like Japanese boy band hair.
Yeah, and I was always staring at it and just thinking, that looks really terrible.
It was worse on it. PS4 was fine.
PS4 was better. It was definitely better.
But you're a PC gamer, we should say.
Yeah. Yes, I like to play games on PC if I can. I try not to be a snob about it most of the time. But I do have a pretty nice gaming PC, and so when it came out on the Windows edition Final Fantasy XV, I played through the whole thing again, And there's actually a lot of stuff that they've added in the past year.
Yeah, they've been updating that game like crazy.
Yeah, and for the most part, it's actually like much better, I would say. I didn't think it was bad to begin with. I just thought it was really sort of imbalanced. And some of that is still there, just like I forgot that they cut off the open world after chapter 3 for like 6 hours of story, and then you can kind of go back to it. But just in general, I think the extra character stuff they added with Ravis and Luna and Noctis as well made it a lot better. Oh, and I played it with Japanese voices instead of English voices.
There you go.
Which was a huge boon. However, there are still not actual translation subtitles.
No, yeah.
It's just the fucking English dub subtitles, and I don't get it. And I don't speak Japanese at all, but I just know they're not saying any of the same shit.
Yeah, like, 90% of the time. Even if you have very minimal experience with Japanese, there's like certain points at which you're like, there's no way they're talking about this. There's no
fucking that was yet. And those certain points was 95% of the game.
Yeah, and you are right, because as someone who can basically speak Japanese, at least more than well enough to understand what they said in that game, the philosophy they took in dubbing that game, we talked about it extensively on this podcast when we were doing the game review, but their philosophy was, how can we put as many puns as possible into this sentence? Which is the most bizarre tack to take, because it's like, you know, Japanese is a language that loves puns, and it's built to have a bunch of interesting puns in a lot of different ways, but not everything has a bunch of puns.
No.
Final Fantasy XV had, like, no puns. It was a very punless game in Japanese, and they thought, apparently for the English version, well, why not fucking fill every single line of dialogue with some weird pun?
I don't understand what kind of audience they're aiming for with that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Kids watching Pokemon in the 90s?
Well, like, but they didn't that kind of do dope? That. Like, yeah. I haven't played most of the other Final Fantasy games, but I've played Kingdom Hearts a lot, and they didn't really do that with those. I wouldn't say those are great.
Because Final Fantasy has had a mixed, like, history with accuracy in its localizations. Yeah. But it's always, I think, been accurate to the spirit of it. Like, you can quibble about individual lines, but it's not like they did a wholesale tonal shift of the game, which Final Fantasy XV does. It's very strange.
Yeah, and to some of it, I wonder how much of that is caused by, like, the weird setting of the game, of, like, this, like, pseudo-fantasy, pseudo-modern thing that game goes for. I wonder if that kind of, like, threw them for a loop, that they're like, oh, we gotta figure out what to do with this. But then they also made, like, bizarre choices, like, naming the Sydney character Cindy. It's like, that Sydney character is a problem anyways, but, like, the whole point is she's supposed to be the Cid of that game. So they made her name. That was like the one pun they actually had in Japanese, was they named the Cid Sydney because she was a lady, and they changed her name to Cindy. It's like, why? You added, like, you took the one pun out and added a million different puns in its place.
And Cid is in the game.
That's true.
So that pun would have made perfect sense in English.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the other thing about the, not to spend too long on this, but just with Cindy and also Ignis and Gladio and just a ton of random characters, the voices and the random, like, accents and dialects they picked for the English dub are just terrible, and they completely mischaracterize a lot of important things. And I realize that especially with Ignis, that he's this, like, uptight British person in the English dub for some reason. And in Japanese, he's more formal than the other...
Yeah, he's definitely more formal, but, he's not...
But that character has enough range where when he does get really emotional in the main game, and especially in episode Ignis... that in English, it ruined it in the main game, and I never even played episode Ignis with the English voices, because I just can't imagine how non-impactful it would be with his stupid British voice.
Well, I'm glad that you played it through in Japanese so that you were able to experience the wonderful performance of Miyuki Sawashiro as Aranea. Is that character?
Yes.
She's great too.
Yes.
She's a great performance. She's a great character.
It got your Miyuki Sawashiro Award for peculiar excellence
that year. Which is a running award on this podcast.
Yes. In any case, I just want to say the Windows Edition, though, it's stupid how good the game looks.
It looks so beautiful. It's incredible.
Because you're running at 4K 60.
Yeah.
And I got to play it for like 5 minutes. It's dumb how good that game looks.
It is incredible.
Yeah.
And it really is, I mean, it's just amazing. Technically, people are complaining about the performance, but I think in general, for what it is, it works really well. And it's just incredible that, you know, through essentially rebuilding that whole game for PC, they made it work so well.
Yeah, 9 times out of 10, that port would have been a disaster.
Yeah, I would not expect a PC Final Fantasy game, or like a port to PC for Final Fantasy, to be well optimized. But yeah, hearing that it's a good port is cool. It feels like Japan is generally getting around to doing good PC ports.
Nier was also a really good port. It didn't have any like enhancements really. It basically looked like you're playing a PS4 game with maybe higher resolution,
right.
But that it worked really well.
Yeah. Nice. So. All right, let's move on to some news.
What's going on in the news, Jonathan?
We're going to start with sad news.
Okay, right, yeah.
This is extra sad for me. Isao Takahata, the co-founder of Studio Ghibli, director of such films as Grave of the Fireflies, yeah, or The Tale of the Princess Kaguya, for which he had an Academy Award nomination for Best Animated Feature, passed away last week at the age of 82. Had a heart condition, I guess, in his final year, and passed away in a hospital last week. And, you know, this is someone who is very near and dear to my heart. If you don't know, I mean, one, I love Studio Ghibli's movies. Isao Takahata is also, was the subject of my master's thesis. And, you know, I wrote, so the thesis is 200 pages. I spent a year of my life on it. It's my favorite thing I've ever written. And so, you know, I would say I know this director very well through all of that. And I think, you know, there's a unique relationship when you get that into someone's work, where this probably has hit me harder than any filmmaker death I've known of in I don't know if in my whole life, but certainly in recent memory. Because you just, obviously, you know, he is not immortal. Right. And 82 is a ripe old age and a wonderful life. But something just, you think they're eternal, especially when you look up to them and write about them, I guess the way I was doing. And, you know, he was, I think, both a wonderful filmmaker, but also a wonderful man and a wonderful human being from everything you could tell. And also one of the most, I think, significant and talented filmmakers to ever walk this earth, period. And if you have any love for the medium that is anime,
yeah,
you owe Isao Takahata a debt of gratitude, because he is one of the pioneers. And I don't mean pioneers in the sense of, like, he was really good at it. I mean,
like, literally,
he was there,
yeah,
day one. Yeah. You know, anime in Japan, animation in Japan wasn't called anime back then. Just, and they had a word for it, doga, back then, which, yeah, they don't use anymore. Because, you know, anime is a popular word. And, you know, it started in Japan in the 60s. That's when animation really comes to Japan. You know, post-war, post-occupation, very Western-influenced at the time. If you look at any animation from the 60s, they're trying to do Disney movies, right?
Yeah, I mean, and it goes back to, like, the beginning of manga as well, with Astro, yes, Boy and all that, mm-hmm, stuff.
And, you know, if there is one film I would urge you to go watch of Isao Takahata's, because I think it's something, just, it's a fundamental piece of film history. It's called The Great Adventure of Horus, Prince of the Sun. It's been distributed by a million different titles. You can usually find it under Horus, Prince of the Sun. And it's from 1968, and it is one of those movies that, if you can pinpoint, like, one movie being kind of like the birth of anime as we know it, or not the, because anime as we know it is so many things, yeah, but I would say, like, I think calling it the Citizen Kane of anime is actually a really apt comparison, because it's a movie that just clicks something into place that so many other movies would then take from.
Right.
What that movie does, and I showed this to Thomas this week, because I needed to watch this movie again, and you hadn't seen it, and I always find it such an awe-inspiring experience, because it is situated in this mode where it has these Disney influences. It's got talking animals, it's got songs, although they're mostly not, like, diegetically sung. They're not, it's not a musical. You know, it's got Western influences in, like, character designs. Characters don't look like what we would say anime characters look like today, generally.
Right.
You know? And yet, what it does with those elements, like with its talking animals, or with its songs, or especially, like, what themes it is exploring, how it has characters with deep psychological realism. There's this character named Hilda, who is essentially the primary figure of the movie. Horus is the protagonist, but Hilda is really the focal point character. And she, you know, I would argue in 1968, there had not been a female character in animation with interiority. And sure, I know that's a broad statement, yeah, to say, but if you want to argue about it with me, we can go through the Disney princesses, you know?
Right.
And they're just, you know, and she has immense complexity and interiority, and it goes for this psychological realism, and it has influences from the French New Wave and Italian neorealism, and it brings all of this together. It's a widescreen movie, which you never see in animation, let alone, like, anime almost never, yeah, does that today. And so it's gorgeous to behold. It's got these experimental avant-garde things near the end. And it is also extremely political, with imagery at the end that is just, like, straight up, like, almost like Soviet kind of propagandist. It's not necessarily being propaganda for that, but it's using this imagery in a very particular way because it is about kind of communal living and like the power of a community or a group of people over individual or bigger evil forces out there. And you know what was happening at the time is that Isao Takahata and Hayao Miyazaki, who also worked on this film, were the leads of the Toei labor union. And so the whole movie is about this. Eventually, it's using this imagery to very not subtly at all, I should say, poke at Toei and the labor union disputes. And because of this, the movie was in theaters for, I think, 10 days before getting pulled and was not seen for years after that, so it was essentially suppressed. But, what this movie did, I think very boldly, is put down a flag and say, not only can animation be more than what the world has seen so far in commercial animation, it can be whatever the fuck it wants to be. And that, to me, is the legacy of anime. Yeah. Is that animation in the United States, in the West, is a genre. It has codes, it has conventions, and it does not break out of those codes or conventions. And if it does, those are exceptions. They don't disprove the rule. Animation is a genre. In Japan, animation is a medium, and it can be whatever the hell it wants to be. And I don't think any person has embodied that more than Isao Takahata, who, never did films in the same genre. Mm-hmm. He barely ever did films in the same animation style. You know, his last two movies, Princess Kaguya from 2013, and then his film before that, My Neighbors the Yamadas, are done, one is done to look like a comic strip, and one is done to look like, sketches, in storyboard art stuff. And so he was boldly experimental, never stopped moving, never stopped trying to innovate on his craft. You know, this is the 50th anniversary of Horus, Prince of the Sun, and throughout his life, he changed and built a medium that is such a huge commercial force today that you can have something like a Crunchyroll, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying he did that single-handedly, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
As a real pioneer. So that is kind of my, both long but also brief obituary to a filmmaker I respect as much as any other. And seek out his work. It's the greatest respect you can pay. And if you're going to watch Grave of the Fireflies, be ready. Yeah. It's about as sad and depressing a movie as exists.
Yeah.
But it is also in no way cloying or sentimental. So that's what I have to say.
Yeah, I don't know if there's much I can add to it because, obviously you know a lot more about him and his work. But yeah, no, it's sad to see someone who is, a part of that pioneering generation of animators from Japan die and pass on. That's it just feels like truly we're coming to the end of an era that, that era of the 50s and the 60s when all that stuff started is a long time ago now. And, and the people that started that and have influenced so much of, obviously, art in Japan, but then art in the world in general are passing on now. But yeah. The most tremendous amount of respect to him as a person and a creator.
And just for me, I had mixed emotions learning of this the same week I was learning of getting into a PhD program because, the writing sample I submitted was from my work on him,
Right.
So I owe him a debt of gratitude, honestly. And I think a lot of people around the world would say that. And, he is much less well-known in the West than Hayao Miyazaki, who was his friend and collaborator at Studio Ghibli. But, if you like, Hayao Miyazaki movies, and who doesn't, you owe it to yourself.
Yeah.
Seek out Takahata. I don't think one is better than the other, but I don't think you can fully understand them both until you see them both,
right.
So, any other thoughts?
Well, I haven't seen most of his films. I think I've only seen Yamada's Horus and Kaguya. And as someone who's not all that interested in art films, certainly not to the extent you are, Jonathan, there's so much beauty in those films, I think. And not just from, like you said, the animation style is always different. But I think when I first watched Kaguya, I spent probably half an hour of that movie in tears. And it's not even necessarily because it was sad. But it's just, it really did amaze me. And if you haven't seen that one yet, I still haven't seen Grave of the Fireflies. But
yeah,
just take whatever opportunities you can because...
Yeah.
They're really experiences.
Grave of the Fireflies and I want to say Pompoko, I'm not sure, but they're going to be in theaters in the United States this year. They're doing a Ghibli Fest, one movie a month. It's Fathom Events, and they will be there. So, go see it on the big screen, too. That's so cool that's an opportunity that's coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to sillier news.
What's going on in the silly news, Jonathan?
Well, speaking of animation, you know, I diss on American animation a lot because it mostly fucking sucks.
Sure, yeah.
But if there is one animator I respect, it is Mr. Brad Bird.
Yeah.
And if there is one animated movie I respect, well, it would probably, I like The Iron Giant and Ratatouille more. But The Incredibles is still fucking awesome.
Yes, it is.
And there's a sequel coming out, and it's The Incredibles 2. And I will admit, I didn't know how to feel about this movie for a while because, you know, Pixar has kind of a hit and miss track record with sequels. The hits are real hits, but the misses are Cars too. So, you know, so there's that. But this is Brad Bird finally coming back 15 years after the original. We'd only gotten these little glimpses of footage, but this week we got a full trailer. And I don't know if I've ever gone so fast from, I don't know how to feel, to I'm sold.
Yeah.
In 2 minutes. That is both a great 2 minutes of footage they gave us, and also like, oh, okay, Brad Bird has thought about this. Like, he's not making this because they gave him a giant check. I mean, they did, I'm sure, but he's got a story to tell, and just the way they're framing it with, like, this time it's about Elastigirl, Mrs. Parr, going on her own kind of adventure of discovery, and it seems like what they're doing with the kids, and how they're, you know, interrogating the Mr. Incredible character, and Samuel L. Jackson seems like he's got a bigger role as one of his, still one of his coolest characters, Frozone.
Yes, no Mace Windu, but Frozone's pretty good.
Frozone's pretty darn good.
Mace Windu didn't have a super suit.
He had a purple lightsaber though.
That's true.
That's true, it all kind of evens out. If you could combine the two somehow. But I watched it, and it's like, the footage is so just like, quick on its feet, and it looks so nice without feeling like it's out of like, aesthetic tone with the original movie, which is 15 years of technology, you know, behind us. I don't know. I was just like, I can't wait for this thing now.
Yeah, I think that in some ways the most impressive part of it to me was that sense of like, this is exactly like the tone and style of The Incredibles, but it is so much more technologically sophisticated than it could have been when Incredibles 1 came out. And it was like, that balancing act is obviously something that has to be incredibly difficult to understand, to like find that sweet spot of like, part of what made the aesthetic of The Incredibles was what was possible in animation at the time, and trying to sort of like be beholden to that and still evolve it. Just based on the trailer, it seems like they have done an excellent job at that. And yeah, I'm really excited to see what it is like what the full story is, where it goes, like the villain and all that kind of stuff. Because it's a good trailer that it teases you like the basic premise for the plot, but doesn't give away that much.
No,
you're sort of like curious to see how it would develop.
It's one of actually the nice things about Disney being so commercially dominant is that they do like less marketing for their movies now. They don't do like the 50 trailer thing. And so I feel like I'm not oversaturated on their films by the time they come out. Like there's only been like the one big Infinity War trailer, right?
Yeah.
Or two maybe. But like those, you know, we haven't seen the whole movie or something. So
it's what happens when you own like half of the filmmaking business in America is you don't actually need to market anymore. You've removed like marketing from the equation because there's nobody to market against.
Exactly. So there's a downside too. But yeah, maybe we'll have to do an Incredibles 1 retrospective episode. Just rewatch that movie because it's so good.
I think the last time I saw that movie, I was in high school. So it has been a while for me.
Because like the last time I saw it was a couple years ago. And there is a scene in the middle of that movie that is still possibly the most impressively choreographed superhero action scene I've ever seen. Which is the big like family fight scene in the forest and on the lake. And like because of Dash, the character who runs really fast, they're able to like just move across all this geography, and it's incredible, but it's kind of the only scene of that scope they can sort of do in the movie. I'm really curious, like, with the technology Pixar has now, what Brad Bird can do. I'm very excited.
Yeah.
And also, he hasn't done animation since Ratatouille. It's been 11 years. So
Ratatouille was 11 years ago?
It's 2007.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're becoming an old man like us, Thomas.
I suppose I am.
We have one of those moments, I think, every week on the podcast.
Well, now that I'm like working with teenagers at high schools, I have one of those moments like every waking second of my life.
I know.
It's like, God, I'm so old. Holy shit.
All right. Well, cool. I'm glad to be excited for a Pixar movie again. All right. Spider-Man. We love Spider-Man.
Yes, he does whatever a spider can, so I hear.
And what a spider can this year is come to the PS4 on September 7th. We finally got a release date. We got some cover art. We got a bunch of new details about the game. But I think easily one of our most anticipated games, Sean.
Yes, like it was beforehand. Now it is. So like how this came out is Game Informer had, which is like the one standing video game magazine, which is one of the like dozen standing magazines left in the world. Game Informer still holding out somehow. They had a cover story on Spider-Man We just, the game is just called Spider-Man, so it's very easy to talk about. But they had a cover story on the game and a bunch of details of it, and they put out a bunch of videos, podcast discussions, that kind of stuff. It was the kind of thing that I normally don't get that into game previews and stuff like that anymore, but for some reason, because of Spider-Man, with this one, I was like, oh, I'm going to look at some of this, and like looked at some like the GIFs, and I was like, oh, those GIFs look really good. That's some good animation, and holy shit, look at the lighting in this game. Like, oh my god. And I looked at some of the details and saw that there's going to be like 20-something different suits in the unlockable suits in the game, and that they
so
give
excited.
You, nice. Yeah, they give you like specific abilities and powers based on which suit you have, and you can upgrade them and shit like that. So it's not just a nice like pre-order bonus. It's like baked into the game that you switch suits, and like getting all those details, and then also seeing the GIF of, I don't know if you've seen this, Jonathan, but the fast travel system in this game is Spider-Man in full costume walks down into a subway, gets on the subway train, and there's just, and like the loading screen as he fast travels is just Spider-Man leaning against his seat in the subway, looking and like poking at his smartphone, and that is the fast travel system in this game.
That is amazing.
Yeah, Insomniac fucking gets it. Like everything they've talked about in those videos with like the different gadgets, the way that the combat system is going to work, the way they're talking about like trying to implement good pendulum physics into the swinging. Like, and just all the little details they've added in, the fact that his eyes, like, grow and shrink, which we've been able to see in the different trailers, but then, like, being able to talk about, like, using that to have the character have a certain degree of expressivity that he normally doesn't have in anything outside of the comic books. Like, just getting that sense of, oh my god, these people actually get it, made me realize, like, fucking holy shit, like really good, hopefully a really good, if not absolute, like, amazing Spider-Man game. Amazing Spider-Man game.
Good.
Yeah, I think perhaps.
I hope the next one is spectacular.
Yeah, a spectacular Spider-Man game. A Peter Parker Spider-Man game, because you play as Peter Parker in it sometimes as well. But like an amazing, awesome, incredible Spider-Man game might be actually around the corner. And I am more excited about this game than I've been. Other than, I guess, like Persona 5 is the last time I've been that excited about a game that's like imminent. And before that, it was a long fucking time. Because like I've become a real jaded motherfucker. It's like getting that excited about game previews and stuff. It's like it made me feel like I was in high school again. I was like, oh my god, it's like I need to consume everything. I listened to their like 30-minute podcast they did and all that shit. Is like, I need to play this fucking video game, Jonathan.
I know. It's so cool because it's the promise of like Spider-Man will get what Batman got with the Arkham games, and I think at its best, a Spider-Man game could be even more fun than a Batman game. So like. Because this is the thing, though, and this is a transition, is that Spider-Man has a decent video game history, but it's always been, like, reaching towards the sun, but we never grabbed it. We never held it, shall we say, in the palm of our hands.
Like the power of the sun, yes. Yeah. That's another good reference. Yeah, so what you're alluding to there, Jonathan, is, do you want me to just go full in on this?
Go full
right
in
now?
On this.
Okay.
Do it.
So, right now what I'm, getting my teacher licensure at MSU Denver and all that stuff means I have a lot of time on the light rail train as I'm heading down to Denver, which is about like, I'd say probably 80 minutes a weekday on that train. I have to find stuff to do. And I found myself sitting there the other day thinking like, you know what? I've played a lot of fucking Spider-Man games. And I just sat there thinking like, I've played enough Spider-Man games to just make a list of Spider-Man games and like rank them, which is something that normally I leave to you, Jonathan, is to do the random list that we have not talked about beforehand that you just spring on this podcast. And I was like, now it's my turn.
I'm glad to be on the other side of it, honestly.
It's my turn. And I discovered I have played 9 Spider-Man games that qualify for me that like they're feature Spider-Man as the main character, have like Spider-Man in the title and everything. Because if I wanted to, I could include like Marvel Ultimate Alliance and a couple of those that have Spider-Man in it. And to be fair, like, I do play as Spider-Man basically most of the time in a game like that, because I'm a huge fan of Spider-Man, but I was like, no, I'm not going to do that, because if I do that, then the best Spider-Man game is Marvel vs. Capcom 2, and it's not fair. That's not an interesting way to end this list. It's like, I'm not going to compare.
That's like saying the best Metroid game is Super Smash Brothers.
Exactly, like, it's just a ridiculous thing to throw in there. It's like, I'm not going to fucking throw Marvel vs. Capcom 2 in there. But so these are the 9 Spider-Man games I've played that have, like, that star Spider-Man as the main character. And I have to mention, before I go into this, like, originally this was actually going to be a bit more of a thing of, like, the idea I had that was germinating was just like, oh, I have played almost every single Spider-Man, like, main Spider-Man game, not like a weird mobile game or something like that, from the Activision era of Spider-Man, Activision got the license to do video game versions of Spider-Man around the year 2000. And I've played almost all the main ones since then, except for, notably, I have not played Amazing Spider-Man 1 or 2, the video game versions, which are the last two movie tie-in video games I can think of on, like, a major console. It's like Activision was still doing that in 2014. They made an Amazing Spider-Man 2 movie tie-in game. This is like...
No one does that.
No one does that. Most people probably don't even know those games exist, and there's a good reason for that also, and there's a good reason why this did not become the full thing of me being like, I'm just going to play every single Activision era Spider-Man game, because I was like, surely I can just pick up Amazing Spider-Man 2, the video game, for like $2. There's like, that game has got to be dirt fucking cheap. I was wrong. That game is like $80 on Amazon, because... Activision, when they lost the license, they couldn't fucking publish the game anymore. So you can't get it digitally. You can't get Amazing Spider-Man 1 or 2 on digital platforms. Like, they're just not there. And even the physical versions are basically discontinued. So you can only get them used. But they didn't make a shit ton of those copies, particularly for Amazing Spider-Man 2, because that was 2014. Like digital game in storefronts was a full thing at that point. So they didn't, like, publish a shit ton of them. So that game is weirdly kind of rare. The Amazing Spider-Man 1, I think, was like $40, but it's like, I'm not going to fucking...
No.
I'm not going to... I don't even really want to play those games that much. Like, it's nowhere near worth $40, and I abandoned the idea at that point. So if anybody... really wanted to play the Amazing Spider-Man 1 and 2 movie tie-in video game adaptations for whatever reason, and you've been waiting on it, and I have bad news for you, you've basically missed the boat for that one, because... They are rare video games. If you do own a physical copy of Amazing Spider-Man 2, congratulations, it has appreciated in value. It is like my copy of Two Human that I have, because they can't make that game anymore either, and I'm sitting on that until it's worth like $1 million someday.
You might be on the other side of the parabola on that one, Sean.
No, it'll get there. Trust me, it'll get there. It's my retirement plan, because sure as shit, nothing else is going to pay for my retirement. So anyways, that is a long preamble to get to my Spider-Man game list. I should also note, I have not played 1 second of any of these games since, like, before making this list or after making this list. Most of these games I haven't even played in this fucking decade. So
true.
A lot of this is going off of, like, severe memory, and that's informing a lot of this list. I did look at YouTube clips of one of these games because I wasn't sure if I had played it or not. Anyways, number 9 is Spider-Man and Venom Maximum Carnage on the Sega Genesis. This is a game I do not own, but I rented a number of times. And it would probably be a little bit higher on this list if I had not, about 4 or 5 years ago, decided to play it again on an emulator and realized it's not a very good video game. Or at the very least, it certainly doesn't hold up. In my memory, it's like, it's a Genesis game, so the sound is awesome. Like, the sprites of Spider-Man and Venom are really huge and they look great. And I still think the game actually looks pretty good and sounds pretty good. But it is a side-scrolling beat-em-up, which is about the worst genre of video games ever. Like, it just ages... Like rotten cheese. Like, it's that genre is just awful these days, and it's sad that I have so many good memories of playing like games like that and Streets of Rage and the TMNT beat 'em up games. And whenever you go back to them, it's always extremely disappointing because they are the most wafer thin video games imaginable. Like, there's basically one button, and you like walk forward when the arrow points to the right and says you can go forward, and you walk up to people and you press the one button that has to punch them in the face, and then hopefully like a cool like Spider-Man like whips them with his web and throws them over his shoulder with like the one special attack animation he has, and that's it. So yeah, Spider-Man and Venom, Maximum Carnage, a lot of great childhood memories of that game. Should never have gone back to it. It would have been a couple places higher.
Mm.
Number 8, this is the game I had to look up on YouTube to make sure that it is the game I played. It is from the Game Boy Advance. It is this and Spider-Man and Venom are the only two that are not published by Activision, so these are the two pre-Activision. It is Spider-Man Mysterio's Menace on the Game Boy Advance. The reason why this game is so low is that it is one of the first Game Boy Advance games I owned, and it is, and within that group, I had like 5 or so Game Boy Advance games, and they were all stolen from me when I was at a basketball game that my brother was having, because basically my entire childhood was me being like dragged from one sporting event my brother was at to another, because he played every sport imaginable, and my parents... I now understand my mom is too cheap to have hired a babysitter. It's like, why bother just like take him with us everywhere? And so it's like, luckily I got a Game Boy Advance basically because of that. Unluckily, there was some bastard, some stupid fucking asshole kid. I assume it must have been a kid. It'd be very sad if an adult stole like this like little case that had all my Game Boy Advance games when I wasn't fucking looking at this sporting event, this basketball game. But yeah, Spider-Man Mysterio's Menace is a side-scrolling action game where you play as Spider-Man. I remember the Green Goblin fight being very cool, and I was very excited for it. I'm sure if I played this game, it would be absolute garbage now. I'm like 90% sure it's not good anymore. I enjoyed it at the time, but whenever I think about it, I just think about the time when I lost my innocence at like, oh right, the world is shit, people are shit, they will steal your fucking video game, so like keep your head on the swivel, kids. Like someone's taking your Switch right now. If you're like listening to this and you're playing on the Switch, be careful, someone's stealing something you own.
I'm not sure how much we're learning about Spider-Man right now. We are learning a lot about the life of Sean Chapman.
It's, you know, it's a deep dive because, you know, it's been a long time since they made Spider-Man games. So most of these games are going way back. Speaking of that, the next game, number 7, is Spider-Man the Movie from 2002 based on the Sam Raimi movie, Spider-Man, which they very conveniently, they did name the game Spider-Man the Movie in case you were worried or to try to trick you into thinking that you were buying the movie and not a kind of okay third-person action game.
Man, DVDs usually only cost $20. This one's $50. It must be a really good movie.
Yeah, no. It's and one thing I should say is that most of these games, other than, like, you know, Mysterious Menace and Maximum Carnage are probably not great games, but they were good at their in their day. But the rest of these games are all, like, at least decent. Like, there's actually not that many, like, awful Spider-Man games. Most of them are, like, kind of okay to, no, this is pretty good. It's sort of, like, the scale used on ranking Spider-Man games. So I don't really hate any of these games. Spider-Man the Movie gets a couple of points for one. Bruce Campbell is, like, the narrator in the game.
That's great.
You know, because he did the cameo in the movies. That's also proves true of Spider-Man 2 and 3 based on the movies. But this was the first one to do it, so get some points for that. It is like a level-based action game, so it's not open world or anything like that. They weren't quite there. It's very much a, when you're like outside, in like one of the outside levels, you're just swinging on like thin air in the sky. The combat system, from what I remember, is pretty like thin and basic for that era. You know, it's a standard movie tie-in game from that era that's maybe a little bit notches, like a couple of notches above like the worst of those, so it's not terrible, but it's like completely unremarkable video game. You should look up some clips for, like, all of the Sam Raimi Spider-Man games where they had Tobey Maguire was contracted to voice Spider-Man in all those games, in Spider-Man 1, 2, and 3, but he did not give a fuck. So if you want to hear Tobey Maguire sound like he's passing out in a, like, acting booth, play any of these games or just look up clips of them because it's fantastic. The next one, number 6, is Spider-Man 3 based on the Sam Raimi movie Spider-Man 3. This was, as far as I know, the first Spider-Man game that was on the Xbox 360 and PS3, which means it was basically the first Spider-Man game in high definition. And you can tell when you go back and play Spider-Man 3 like I did like 5 or 6 years ago, being like, this is a game that came out right around the turn of that console generation, and holy shit does it look terrible. The character models are awful. The city has horrendous pop-in. But it is open world. It does have some of the core physics that Spider-Man 2 had. So, it, you know, you're swinging around, attaching to buildings, like, you know, using pendulum physics and stuff like that. But it is an incredibly rough game, technically speaking. It has some very infamous QuickTime events that's another
those
fun...
Those are terrible. Yeah.
This is a fun thing to do on YouTube is just look at all, like, the failed animations for QuickTime events. Like, the most infamous of one is from the very beginning of the game, where there's all these explosions going off, and he's swinging around, like, trying to save this hostage. And if you miss, like, one of the button prompts, he just sort of, like, falls off this railing, face plants on the ground, the hostage looks at him, and thinks just basically says, "We're gonna die!" And then it's, like, an outside shot of the building exploding. So there's some great comedy to be found in this game, unintentionally so.
That game also has some really long QuickTime events.
Oh, like, yes.
I remember there's a fight with Green Goblin 2 or whatever he
yes,
is.
Yes, yeah, the
Jim Franco Goblin. I think, yeah.
But that's like, that whole fight is QuickTime stuff, yes. And it's like 5 minutes long.
Yeah, I mean, this was like 2005, 2006. God of War was like a new game at this point.
It would have been 2007 is when this came out.
Oh, so yes, yeah, 2007. Movie. So it's like, so that's the year that like God of War 2 came out, right, for context. So
like, I have played the most of this one on your list. Okay. And it, I mean, I don't know what the next 5 games are, but I just know I've played the most of this one. And I was into it at the time, while also knowing, like, I'm not enjoying a lot of this, but it's a big open city, and I'm Spider-Man, and it's HD, and it's cool. But yeah, I have not revisited it since it came out.
Don't.
Yeah.
Don't. Yeah. It's a rough game in a lot of ways, but again, there's a lot of fun to be had, particularly if you're a fan of Spider-Man. You can laugh at the bad QuickTime event animations. You can laugh at the just terrible Tobey Maguire voiceover. Because this is the third one they dragged him into that booth to record. It's like, he was really done by this point. The other thing I was going to say about this is that this was kind of like, in a much more minor way, but it kind of like with the Mysterious Menace game, I have like a bad memory associated with this one in terms of, this was like the first time I ever had a game that had like an exclusivity component of it for the other console. Because this was, I had it on Xbox 360, and on PS3, you could play as the James Franco Goblin in like some of the levels and stuff, and but not on the Xbox 360 version. I've never played that.
I have not either.
I have no idea. Maybe if I had, this would be number one with a bullet. You get to play as like a bad knockoff James Franco and with your weird like skateboard.
Sean, I think we know if we bring back our Let's Play series, what we have to do. Full playthrough of Spider-Man 3 on the PS3.
I have already planned out all of that in my head in the off chance that it's something we wanted to do. Yeah. Don't worry. I had a lot of time on the train to think about this list and everything we could do with this list. My number 5 game... Going back in the past is Spider-Man 2000. This is developed by, this was Neversoft, who were also making like Tony Hawk games at the time. And this was one of the first Activision games, like one of the first like main games that Activision made after they acquired the Spider-Man license. This is on like the N64, the PS1. I played the N64 version originally. And then I got like super cheap. This is probably like 2005 or 2006. I got like the bargain bin at a Best Buy. I got the PC version of the game because it's like, I remember loving this game when I was a kid. Got that PC version, installed it, and it's like, that game's actually pretty fucking good. Like, it's
good.
It's obviously like dated in a lot of ways, and the graphics, you know, it's a PS1 era game. So it's like, you know, keep your expectations in check. But for a like level-based Spider-Man game, there's a lot of fun there. It's got a lot of charm. You know, it doesn't have Bruce Campbell as the narrator, but it does have Stan Lee as the narrator. And they've got a pretty good sense of like Stan Lee's voice from like those old Spider-Man comics. Because this is also would have been around the time I was going back and reading those old comics and like the big omnibuses they released. And so, you know, there's a lot of that like, look out, webheads, like scorpions on the loose, and a lot of that kind of stuff from Stan Lee. It's got a pretty good, for like the time, kind of video game Spider-Man story. I think it had the voice cast from the cartoon from the era, so it had that going for it. There's a lot of Venom stuff in it. At the end, you fight Carnage Doc Ock, where the Carnage symbiote takes over Dr. Octopus, and there's this big, like, Crash Bandicoot style, like, you running at the camera trying to get away from Carnage Doc Ock, because you can't fuck with that shit. That's like Carnage and Dr. Octopus combined. That's a fucking awesome idea that, as far as I know, has only been in that game.
I don't think I've ever played this one to completion, but it is, like, a pretty good precursor to, like, the Batman Arkham games, or what I think this Insomniac game is going to be, and that it wasn't, like, here's a Spider-Man movie, let's make the game. It was just a Spider-Man game, and it's well-written and well-done, and, like, for the era, especially, very good.
Yes, and you know, it obviously was not open-world web-swinging. Like, you could web-swing. Like, you web-swung exactly twice. That was his limit. You just fire one web-swing, fire another web-swing, and that's it. You have to land, or you can't go again.
He has very, you know, small web holders.
Yes, it was, you know, he was a young Spider-Man at the time. But the other thing that was cool about that game that still is better than, like, I think any of the other Spider-Man games on this list, other than maybe one, maybe other than the next one, is it had a bunch of unlockable costumes that all did stuff. So, like, you could play as Peter Parker, but if you did, you use the Peter Parker skin, but you could only have, like, two web cartridges or something like that. And if you unlocked the black suit, you had infinite web and a bunch of stuff like that. Like one of them, like the spider armor had extra health and that kind of stuff. And that was really cool. And having all like the cheat codes and unlockables and stuff. You know, back in the day when video games had unlockables and cheat codes and they didn't just make you pay for all of it.
Yeah.
Number 4, Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions. This is the most recent game, Spider-Man game I've played. This is from Beenox, their inaugural Spider-Man game. They are the studio that then, after making this game, they are forced to make a terrible sequel that just, like, they had to shit out in, like, half a year, and then they threw them into the movie tie-in bus, and Beenox made Amazing Spider-Man 1 and 2. So, Activision did bad things to the studio, but Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions is a game made by a fresh studio at Activision, like, ready to make an interesting game that's not attached to a movie or anything. It's like, here you go, Beanox, like, make the best Spider-Man game you can. They decided not to go open world, which was the reason why I originally didn't play it and got it several years later when it was on sale for the 360. Because it's like, why do I want to play an old, like, action platformer, like level-based Spider-Man game after we've already had a bunch of open world ones? But this game has so much heart to it, has so much charm. It's the game where you can play as four different Spider-Men. It's the Amazing Spider-Man, played by Neil Patrick Harris, because all of them are voiced by different people who voiced them from the different cartoon series. You have the Ultimate Spider-Man, who is voiced by Josh Cheaton from the Spectacular Spider-Man cartoon. You've got Spider-Man Noir, who I think is voiced by the guy from the old 90s cartoon. And then you have Spider-Man 2099, the future Spider-Man. I don't remember who voices him. But you have the four different eras of Spider-Man, all kind of colliding in this big, like, epic Spider-Man story that pulls these different four versions of the characters together. And you fight all these different villains from the different eras, and they all have different play styles. Like, Spider-Man Noir is very stealth. Like, Ultimate Spider-Man is, like, really over-the-top action. Amazing Spider-Man, like, original Spider-Man, is a bit more, like, action platformer kind of thing. It's just a game that has a tremendous amount of heart in it. You can tell the studio loved making the game. It has flaws. It's not super deep. I think in some ways it doesn't do a great job of capturing, like, the gameplay feel of Spider-Man, even if it captures, like, the aesthetic and, like, the fan passion behind it. Not having stuff like being able to, like, web swing and have, like, the pendulum physics and all that stuff, it's pretty hard to go back to a Spider-Man game that doesn't have that stuff. But this is about as good as a non-open world Spider-Man game can be, probably, because, you know, it's got so much heart to it. It is another tragedy to me that they never got to make an honest second attempt. That's like, Shattered Dimensions is such a good foundation. Activision just destroyed that studio immediately after this game came out. I assume it probably didn't sell fantastically, but it's, if you are a fan of Spider-Man, I think it is worth it to go back and get this game, because you can get it super cheap and check it out. Spider-Man Shattered Dimensions is a lot of fun. Now to our top three. Number three is Spider-Man Web of Shadows. This is open world. It is not movie tie-in, so it is an original story. This game is, like, this game should be the number one in so many ways, but it is incredibly buggy. It's really unpolished and rough around the edges, but it has probably the best combat system in any Spider-Man game I've played. It's got a lot of move variety. It's got a lot of different moves and skills you can unlock as you play through the story. The story is bad, but in a ridiculous way that you can basically play through as good Spider-Man or evil Spider-Man. So it almost feels like the Infamous games in some ways. Is like, here's the actual story of the game, and here's if, like, Peter Parker just utterly lost his shit, got the black symbiote suit, and just decided, I'm going to literally, like, rip Wolverine in half and murder the villains. Like, he just murders people. This is another great Spider-Man game to look up YouTube clips of. The evil version of the story is utterly ridiculous, but being able to have that, like, sort of dark Marvel universe feel to it, there's a bunch of other Marvel, like, not Spider-Man specific characters like Luke Cage and Wolverine in the game, and that's a lot of fun. It is open world and you're swinging around. It does sort of fudge the specific, like, sticking to buildings thing. Like, it tries to mostly be like, that web is clearly attaching to that building, but it is not exacting with that. And so it has a good feel to the web swinging, but it doesn't have a lot of depth or, like, gameplay variety to it. And so that's probably the main thing that gets down to number three. But this is another Spider-Man game, like with Shattered Dimensions, that if you're a fan of Spider-Man and you have not played Web of Shadows, I would recommend picking it up. It is a lot of fun. It is insanely cheesy. It is a good time. Number two is Ultimate Spider-Man. This is the game that studio made after Spider-Man 2. It is based on the Brian Michael Bendis Ultimate Spider-Man comic books, which are one of my favorite versions of that character. It is full open world. It is full, like, you are sticking the webs to buildings, like pendulum physics, all that stuff. It's got a great graphical style that I think still holds up today, that it really tries to capture the feel of the art from that comic book, and it really pops. They're not going for anything realistic in that. It's got a bunch of cameos of other characters like Wolverine and Black Cat and stuff like that. Great cast of characters, great voice acting. But there is just something in the game in terms of the gameplay that, for me, it doesn't quite hit the zenith of the next game that I'm going to talk about. That's like, there's the sense of speed isn't quite there. Some of the complexity of the web swinging isn't all the way there. It feels like it kind of dumbed the game down in some ways. You do get to play as Venom for some sections of the game, and that's pretty interesting. And the game is a sort of pseudo-canonical sequel to the Venom story arc from the comic book. And so that stuff is cool. This is another, like, if you're a fan of Spider-Man, particularly if you're a fan of the Ultimate Spider-Man comic book, you should absolutely pick this game up. It is awesome. I have no idea how easy it is to get these days, but it is a great time.
Can I give a quick update?
Yes.
I looked on the PlayStation Store. I just searched Spider-Man to see what's even there, and most... There's almost nothing on there other than the new game that's coming out. But I did notice you can still buy the Spider-Man 3 new Goblin DLC. It's $2.99. But you can still get it for your PS3.
It's amazing how DLC just never degrades in price. No. You know? Like, it should be a penny at this point.
Yeah, but you can get it. Yeah, none of these other ones are up here. Like, I don't think they've... I was hoping maybe, like, some of the movie ones they'd put on their PS2 thing they've done for PS4, but they haven't.
No, I assume they probably can't.
That's true, they probably can't, yeah.
So, like, I think anything new from those licenses is, like, a... You know, that's a thin hope so that you could get an updated version of any of these games. Some of these I'm sure you can get, like, old used copies of.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But yeah.
There's plenty of, especially if it's PS2 era.
Exactly. So yeah, because Ultimate Spider-Man is like PS2, Xbox One, GameCube, that era. The next game, my number one, what I still think is the best Spider-Man game, uncrowned, it has been this for a long fucking time, is Spider-Man 2, the movie tie-in game. The best Spider-Man game happens to be based on the best Spider-Man movie, so go figure. They really tried that time around. It is by no means a perfect game. I don't know if I would call it a great game. Again, this is a scale of, like, it's okay to, that's pretty good. So, like, being number one Spider-Man game is still, that's pretty good. And it's only, like, a, like, must-play if you're a big Spider-Man nerd. But Spider-Man 2 is the game that went open world, back when open world was also a very novel thing. That was, like, 2004, 2005. So, you know, open world was still mostly GTA clone at the time.
Or Morrowind.
Yeah, or Morrowind. Like, it was, you either had, like, the PC crazy, like, open world RPG, or you had the console GTA, like, go to, like, the fucking, like, initial on the map that has the mission giver and that kind of stuff. And
that's still what GTA is.
The GTA still has not moved past that formula. The open world games have now gone to, you know, the world gets nuked at the end. That's like where we've arrived with that genre. This is when, like, ignore Ubisoft's tower, like, bullshit and icon barf and, like, all the stuff we have with open worlds now. This is where, like, just the idea of, I can just play as Spider-Man and swing around what is now just a butt-fucking-ugly version of New York City, of Manhattan specifically. At the time, it was like, this is Manhattan, holy shit, the buildings are really big, and, you know, there are cars on the street. To be fair, when you get very high up, those cars are 100% just sprites and are not actual 3D models anymore. But at the time, like, I didn't know any of that shit. And so the idea of just, like, swinging around in open world Manhattan as Spider-Man, having Bruce Campbell pop in at the beginning of new chapters saying, like, some quippy line, having Tobey Maguire, you know, like, snoring through the voice acting, it's like, this is great. This is like playing my favorite movie. And like, as my favorite character from my favorite comic books. And the thing that Spider-Man 2 had, that it still has, that is still unsurpassed, that makes it the best game, is the web swinging is so much better than any game before or since. I'm very curious to see how the Insomniac game will compare to it, because it is, like, surprisingly complicated, and there's a lot more to it than just, like, hold down right trigger and you just swing. It is the webs attached to specific points on the buildings. It has full pendulum physics, so if you want to go fast, that means you have to release the web at the bottom of the arc, because that's when you have the most speed. And if you want to go high, you release it when you're at the tip of the arc, so that you go up and you have no forward velocity, but only upward momentum. And that's how you navigate the city. You can shoot two webs out at the same time, which is something that none of the other games do. So if you, like, hold down R2 and then release and press it again really quick, he actually shoots out another web that you can then transition to that. So you can do the thing that typically is how Spider-Man is shown web swinging, which is less the I swing on one web and then I launch myself off of it super far and then shoot another web, which is how all the other video games do it. And it is, like, a really effective way of getting around to Spider-Man 2. But most Spider-Man stuff shows Spider-Man web swing, then at the end shoots another web, lets go of the old one and swings on that one. And that's, you know, that's like the classic animated GIF from the old 60s cartoon and stuff. You can do that in this game, or you cannot. You can web zip, you can, like, wall run on buildings, and it's all chained together through a really skill-based gameplay system that rewards you mastering it. And once you master it, you can just fucking sling through that city so fast that literally Manhattan can't load and keep up with you. It's like playing GTA 4 or something. It's just like, I have left the textures behind, the cars are not loading anymore, the audio is all fucked up, but I am just fucking booking it, man. And that feeling is awesome. And I still have just great memories of like swinging up to the top of the Empire State Building in that game and jumping, like leaping off and splatting onto the ground and doing just silly open world hijinks in a way that none of the other Spider-Man games have quite caught up to. And so my big hope is that, you know, this is a game that is like 13 or 14 years old at this point. My desperate hope is that Insomniac can at least match that, if not overcome. I'm sure Insomniac are easily going to overcome the bad combat and the bad story and all that stuff. It's like that fucking web swinging was so good in that game that it has in some ways like sunk every single developer that has taken up the task afterwards. Because, and you can see this in any forum discussion on this new Spider-Man game, you can see just how fucking nitpicky and annoying Spider-Man fans are. Like, no, it has to be like, you calculate the momentum and the velocity based on this animated GIF release of the alpha test footage of this game, you can tell that they're fucking everything up compared to this like YouTube video, and it's like the fucking, like, you know, scientific theses written on the fucking pendulum physics in Spider-Man 2 and like comparing it to other Spider-Man games occupies what has to be like several terabytes of information on the internet. So this game casts a long shadow, and I'm excited to see what Insomniac can do.
All right. We'll come back here in this slot next week when I rank every Harry Potter game I've ever played.
How many Harry Potter games do you think
I've played? I don't know. Because I also have multiple versions of them. This actually would be an activity that I should probably do someday. I'm not doing it next week.
No.
I would also like to mention there are multiple versions of the Spider-Man movie tie-in games as well.
That is true.
There's all the handheld ones.
Well, and I would just like to mention the one game I've played that is not on that list is the Spider-Man 3 Nintendo DS game.
Oh.
Which is just crap.
Okay.
Yeah. I remember...
I was really excited. I thought for a second you were going to be... And it's amazing.
No,
it's
like, it was terrible.
Oh my god,
it
still
was,
have my old DS.
It was worse than probably all of those.
Is it three or two that you had?
It might have been two,
I
actually.
I think it's two.
But I don't remember because I remember the combat was so terrible that I never bothered getting far enough into it to do anything.
Yeah.
It's sort of like a side-scrolling beat-em-up, but it was just bad.
I should know, also thinking about that, that Spider-Man 3 was a cross-gen game. If you want to see some amazing shit, go look up Spider-Man 3, like, PS2 version on YouTube.
I didn't know that was a thing.
It is the most ugly, fucking ugly game you've ever seen. It is
nice.
So bad. It's just, it's so desperate, like, they're trying to sort of find a way to get that game to work on a PS2. It's like, oh my god, this console is just dying trying to make this game work.
All right, well, I think we've run out of time for the news, so I'll do one last quick thing, which is that, Sean, Shenmue, which you love.
I like Shenmue, yes.
You gave it your I Like Shenmue award in 2016.
Yes.
Yeah, very coveted award.
Yes, Shenmue recipient of the I Like Shenmue award.
Yes, Shenmue 1 and 2 are, we thought this might never happen.
Yeah.
It's getting a remaster collection. It's coming to PS4, Xbox One, and PC this fall. It'll be a two-pack, so you get them together. It's only $29.99. It'll have a physical version as well, which is great. It has English and Japanese voices.
Which is desperately needed. Do not, I repeat, if you thought Final Fantasy XV's dub was bad, for God's sake, do not play Shenmue in English. Don't even try. Not even once.
For the first time, kind of ever, these games will be easy and accessible to play.
Yes.
And I have never played them. I've always wanted to. I am psyched to be able to have a chance to play what you have called the Citizen Kane of gaming.
Yes, the Citizen Kane of video games is here. It's real. And now it will be easily accessible in your home.
And we are going to do multiple podcast episodes about these. You better believe it.
Yes, yeah, I'm definitely picking these up because I've never gotten back around to Shenmue 2. Like, I kept on trying to, but I played Shenmue 1, like, in 2016, and that's right when the video game apocalypse happened.
Yes.
So, it's like, there has not been enough of a break to sit down and be like, now it's finally time to put some time into Shenmue 2 and, like, have to do, like, all the emulated bullshit and shit that I would need to, like, actually be able to play that game today. So, yeah, them releasing remastered versions of those games, that's awesome. I'm going to replay through Shenmue 1. We'll do podcasts on it, play through Shenmue 2, do podcasts on that.
And then one day Shenmue 3.
Yes, one day. One coveted day, someday from now.
Probably before Kingdom Hearts 3.
I don't know. We have a wager going.
Yeah.
I don't know whose list that breaks down our list.
No, I don't think we had Shenmue 3 on our draft thing, because I don't think it's... I think it was supposed to come out next year, right?
I don't remember.
We'll find out.
It's a Kickstarter. Yeah. I will stay with Shenmue. It was interesting that... Like, yesterday or 2 days ago, I was listening to the soundtrack to Shenmue, just, like, on a whim. I was like, this soundtrack's really good. I was listening to it and thinking, man, fucking Shinmue's so awesome. It was like I was reading something in the air. It's just like, Shinmue's coming. It's coming. And that soundtrack is so good. The way they made that soundtrack is they basically just like took together, like they made a super band of all the great Sega composers of the 90s. Like the guy who did like the Daytona soundtrack, like Yuzo Koshiro, the guy who did all the Streets of Rage soundtracks. Oh, like all those guys just came together and like made one fucking awesome soundtrack. So Shinmue 1 and Shinmue 2, I assume, has like amazing music.
I'm excited. It's,
those games are awesome.
All right. You guys want to talk some Persona?
Yeah.
I mean, that's why we brought him here.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Do you want to do the animation first or dancing stuff first?
Let's do the animation first because I think it's easier to get
animation
through.
Animation first.
All right. And then the dancing thing is a little more indulgent, so we'll save that to the end.
Yeah.
All right. So Persona 5, the animation, premiered last week. It's airing Saturdays. It's up on Crunchyroll, like Saturday mornings, afternoons. And I'm very curious. I put out my thoughts on episode 1. I haven't talked to you about it, Sean.
Yeah.
We'll hear what Thomas has to say, too. I didn't really like the first episode. They had to rush through so much material to get to where the point where they decided to get in 22 minutes that it just felt like watching the game on fast forward for in a span of 20 minutes, and it just was really whiplashy. Episode 2 I feel better about because they slowed down. I still, it's really just the game so far, and because Persona 5 is, you know, it's a PS4 game, it's such more advanced on a graphical level than the other games, it doesn't feel like you're gaining as much by seeing these scenes staged in full animation. There's good things about it. The animation is amazing. It's really good, especially for, you know, TV weekly animation. It's incredible. It's A1 Pictures, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Who did the Persona 3 movies and Persona 4 the Golden Animation, and they are top-notch at what they do. Voice acting's obviously great, and the music, oh god, I'm in love with it, especially that theme song.
Yeah.
I have some concerns, because I think this is a fairly dry adaptation so far, and also, if this is 26 episodes, which is what we're assuming, I don't know how the fuck you fit this in 26 episodes. This already seems like, I have no idea how you get it in under the wire on that.
Yeah, I mean, because it's basically, you either have to be like 26 episodes, or it'd have to be like 50 episodes, is kind of how the scheduling would work out. And so it's like, you know, like, most anime do not get more than one core, if not two cores, which is like, one core is like 12 to 13 episodes, two cores obviously add on to that. So yeah, like that's, you know, that's what kind of what's expected. I more or less agree with you. And this is also like, I would not normally watch this show like this. I would wait until it was all done and marathon it, because I think that's a more satisfying way to watch something like this. But yeah, it is really rushed. It has to, you know, that first episode basically needs to get to the Persona moment by the end to try to, like, hook viewers in. Because, you know, this show is more made for people who have not played the game than people who have played it. So it's like, you need to get that, like, big, like, holy shit moment at the end of the first episode and, like, justify why it's called Persona, right? And so, but to reach that point, you have to cut through a lot of stuff. So there's a lot of little character things that they have to cut through, like the meeting with your teacher at Kawakami at school and all that stuff. Like, that stuff is really truncated down to try to funnel you to the point at the end of that episode. I do think episode 2 improves. It gets to slow down a little bit. It gets to focus on some of the other characters. I think it's able to do some things to kind of like focus in on a little like of the like facets of the characters that you don't get to necessarily always see in Persona 5 that are more like alluded, you understand are true from the dialogue, but you don't get to like have the power of editing and flashbacks or whatever of like, you know, getting to see Kamoshida how like how awful he is. Like that would have been hard to do in the Persona 5 engine, whereas like in when you have a full animated, like what would have been that game a cutscene, you get to see him like actually physically abusing
characters. A character,
and stuff like that. Or like, you know, I thought one of the smart things they did was add in that little scene in episode 2 where Kamoshida is like throwing spikes at the main character, Rin, and like basically showing you like this is kind of how he does it. It's like, it's other than like the blatant physical abuse going on behind closed doors, there's also the like pressure and like sort of like from his perspective probably justifiable physical abuse on the court that's like, they can't quite fire this dude for this because of all the accolades he has, and it's like not quite over the line, but you can see the psychological pressure it has on the students. Like I thought them adding in those little bits was effective, but it is still very much like you have to cut to the next scene and cut to the next scene and cut to the next scene to try to get through what is like the introductory phase of the game.
Yeah, you know what, Thomas, what did you think so far?
Well, I was just going to say, I am more leaning towards Sean's opinions, where I think that the first episode was rushed, but I also don't know where else they could have ended it that would have been satisfying. And I would just like to mention that I did find that ending very satisfying.
Oh, again, it is. It's well done.
And that's more what I was thinking about. I wasn't necessarily focused on its faults. I was sort of just trying to enjoy it a little more. I guess I'm just not as critical in general, but...
That's okay. We host a podcast.
Yeah, we've been doing this for a long time.
You know, that's just I don't think about things that way as often.
It's healthier.
Yeah, it's better to be you.
Yeah, it's a little easier for certain. But I was just enjoying it. I absolutely love the music and the animation. And there are some things in the second episode that are different than in the game. Sort of like Sean was mentioning, there's a little more with Kamoshida. I think there's a little more character development with Sakamoto.
Ryuji.
Yeah.
Because they just... It's well written. They focus it around his character for that second episode.
Yeah, and... you know, because of that, we don't get a lot of focus on Morgana, but also, you know, that comes later in the game anyway. And I also kind of wonder if they had to rush to make him more sympathetic because they're not going to have much time down the road because there are so many other characters they have to get to. But I did like their approach specifically to his character and to Ren in the first two episodes, how they sort of have started to characterize him as well.
Yeah, I particularly like the beat they end episode 2 on where Yuji is all like, yeah, Ren, like, my buddy, and he's like, yeah, that's cool, Sakamoto. And it's just like, oh, you asshole. Yeah. Like, what?
That's been the biggest spark for me in these two episodes is the end of episode 2. Yeah. I thought that was like, okay, that's something to latch on to. I guess I just, yeah, I think these have good, I mean, it's extremely well made. I mean, we should say that, like, the animation is on par with the cutscenes in the games. And it's very impressive so far. When it needs to do something cool, it's very cool. It is stylish and slick as hell. Like, the way they get into and out of the theme songs. God, and, like, the next episode, that was... like, honestly, my favorite things have nothing to do with the storytelling. It's, like, how they do the next episode preview at the end of episode 2 into the ending song. Just all of that is, like, again, just slick as hell. They're edited kind of interestingly on Crunchyroll, where it's like an HBO episode or something. They don't have any commercial break. And I'm not sure where
they are. That's basically how it is.
Okay, for a lot of
Yeah, for like late night anime. Yeah, you don't have like a cut in the middle.
Oh, okay. That's too bad. I was hoping they would show his social stats again.
Yeah, they had really fun ones.
For the Persona 4, the animation had those. Yeah.
The Golden also had really fun ones with the still images on the TV.
Yeah. So anyway, but it's very slick. They're very watchable. This is so like Persona 5 on fast forward, and I don't envy the job they have, because my mind, it boggles the mind, because Persona 5 is at least a 100-hour game, and of course there's dungeon running and stuff like that, but even then, it is such it's 100 dense hours.
Yeah.
And so many of it's, and also the mechanics are so tied to the story, there are things that in most games would be easy cuts for an adaptation that I don't think you can cut in Persona 5. They're going to have to do something with Mementos, because it's the way that game ends.
Yeah, they're going to have to do, like, some like the side cases and stuff like that need to be in there.
They're going
to
have to do virtually all the confidants in some way to like get the scope of the story.
And it's going to have to be more than just sort of flashing images like it is in
Persona 3 and 4.
Yeah,
because they're more tied in specifically with the main character in the story arc in Persona 5.
You have, you know, all the palaces, but the palaces also have really complicated things going on, and you can't, unless you really heavily adapt it, what is, you know, half video game mechanic stuff, like sending the calling card, and half, you know, story stuff, which is the calling card has immense story, you know, impact. There's just a lot they're going to have to get through. And, like, I'm curious, does the Kamoshida arc... can they fit the rest of it into the next episode?
And I was... because we were talking about this earlier, is there are 8 palaces in the game if you include the Mementos depths at the end. And that means if it's only 26 episodes, that's 3 episodes per, essentially, story arc.
Right.
I'm really hoping it's more than that. I hope it's
Don't know.
But I don't know.
Who knows? It would be weird to think it would be. But yeah, I mean, assuming they have 26... I'm just very curious to see what they can do with it, because I said this about Persona 4, the animation, when I talked about it a couple weeks ago, Sean, that, like, that's pretty much also just a very straight adaptation, although it has more time to play, because Persona 4 is a looser, shorter game, and that kind of thing kind of bores me. But, you know, I loved the Golden animation, where it was just, they were completely free from format and could do whatever the hell they wanted. And I love the Persona 3 movies, because they clearly had such immense artistic control, and it fit that format so well. I'm very curious. Persona 5 is a difficult beast, because it just is so goddamn long.
Yeah.
And complicated. But I'm curious to see where they go with it.
Yeah, like, I'm hoping that once they get through, like, the first 4 or 5 episodes, because, like, so much of it is also, like, introducing, like, because obviously they're going to still keep on introducing new characters, but it's like, you know, you need like that core main cast of the main character Morgana, Ryuji, and An. Like, you need like, that's like that core four. Like, you need them, and it's like you need them established. And so that's one of the things I think makes it feel like on Fast Forward, is that it's like we need to get this like core group of characters established so that we have a core cast so that we can have more of like the little character moments, because that is the stuff like I'm most enjoying about watching these, is like the little, like, obviously I'm like interested by the little like extra bits they add, but even like the stuff that's from the games, like seeing the character interactions in that kind of like nicely edited, fully animated perspective, like that's something I really enjoy.
Oh, it's, yeah, it's definitely a ton of fun. If, you know, obviously anime airs in very rigid ways, you know. The ideal way to do this, honestly, would be something like if you could have an hour-long first episode.
Yeah.
And if you could air some of the earlier ones all, like, in a chunk, kind of like Twin Peaks The Return did, where you had, like, four in a week. And that was just like, okay, that, you to get into it was really nice. And American TV can do that really frequently. Yeah.
There's, like, there are some anime that have done that. And, like, I was kind of hoping that they would have done that for Persona 5, because I think that would have been a way to, in the first episode, at that Persona, like, awakening, like, holy shit, he ripped the mask off his face and his bloody is fucking awesome, fire shooting everywhere, like, look at asshole Kamoshida shitting his pants and everything. Like, that's a great moment, but, like, to get to that moment in 22 minutes, you have to do a lot of stuff. If they could have done, like, the double premiere episode, that would have been a nice way to sort of circumvent that. But, yeah, like, obviously, you know, all that stuff has to exist around these weird scheduling concerns, and they're adapting a really long game.
There's only so many slots a week. Yeah. I mean, you know.
It's the kind of thing that, for me, the ideal Persona 5 animation, because this is something I felt when they showed that, like, they had that, like, special bonus preview episode or whatever you want to call it, the Daybreakers thing from when the game launched. And it was, like, a little, like, a nicely animated version of one of, like, the really small side quests in that game where, like, the guys, you know, it's the Kaitodon versus the Setodon, like, the like, pickpockets or whatever the fuck, like, that translated in English, like, the thief group, the Phantom Thieves versus, like, the normal thieves. That little episode is really awesome, and it made me want, like, a Persona 5 animation that is mostly about, like, you have the main cast together, and it's them just, like, solving normal cases. And it's, I could 100% see, this is obviously not what it is, and it's not what it would ever, like, realistically be, but, like, creatively speaking, a, like, weekly anime that was just, like, this week, we tackle this weird target and, like, infiltrate their heart and find out, like, they're an asshole this way and solve that problem. And then, like, the bigger story arc stuff is all happening in the background.
And I agree. Like, I think the best Persona TV show I've seen is The Golden for The Golden. And it's because they've done all the busy work of laying the foundation and getting the characters in and telling the main story, which the game is always going to do better in this format, at least. Like, the Persona 3 movies buck that trend a little bit, but they have such a different format. Like, being a movie forces them to change so much, you know? That the Golden animation just got to be very episodic, and the cast is all there, and there's so much more room for invention on the, you know, scriptwriters' parts, and you get to be so much more free of structure, and it works as a TV show better. And, like, if they could do this, like, I would prefer, like, a Persona 5 animation that just, like, kind of maybe skip the just telling the story and do what you're talking about of, like, episode 1, they're all already together. Like, Daybreakers is episode 1. And then you do more of that for, you know, 25 weeks or something and see where you go from there. And who knows, maybe we will get a Persona 5 The Golden animation at some point. And I do get what you mean. Like, obviously this is for people who have played the game, but also substantially for people who haven't, also with the goal of selling them the game.
Exactly, yeah.
Because anime is a commercial at one point, you know?
Yeah.
So I get it, but it's also, it's not the most exciting. But who knows? It could change. It's only 2 episodes.
Yeah.
2 episodes is nothing.
Yeah, again, because that's like 40 minutes, basically, of animation, the story that you're getting in 2 episodes. And so, yeah, it's something of, this is something I would more recommend for someone who has not played the game so far than someone who has.
I was thinking this, though. In what way is this coherent if you haven't played the game? Like, it goes so fast.
I think you'd be able to pick up on it, like, easier than you think.
Okay.
Like, I think, yeah. I don't think it would be that hard to sort of, like, understand what's going on. Because it is a fast pace. But I think, like, I think part of the reason why it feels like a fast pace to us is because we know all the stuff that they're skipping over. So it's like, oh, God, like, you're skipping over that stuff. Whereas if you have no preconceptions of what that's doing, I think you would be a lot easier at accepting the pace that at least these 2 episodes have moved at. So it's like if you're someone who like doesn't have a PS4 or you're not interested in playing an hour long or a 100 hour long JRPG, I think this is the, probably will hopefully be a good alternative to that and still be able to get a lot of the good plot and like character stuff in the style of Persona 5 without having to go through the sort of laborious process of doing everything in Persona 5.
Also, that theme song.
That theme song's freaking
good. Song is really good.
Yeah, Break In to Break Out. I mean, the song itself is just, it's jaw-dropping. It is so fucking good. Like, I didn't think, like, I don't think it's, like, necessarily better than the songs in the game, but it is on par, and that's just an amazing thing. Like, I love all the theme songs for Persona 4, the animation, but I think this one's even better than those.
Yeah.
And the animation for it that you get in Episode 2, which it looks like they might have set it up in a way where they can replace it with footage every
week. That's what I'm hoping, because, yeah, a lot of it is, like, sort of stock animation from the other episodes. I guess it's not technically stock animation, but, like, it's episode animation from, like, the previous episode at the beginning of Episode 2. And so it would not, it doesn't make sense to me that every single episode would have it all be like, this is all animation from episode one.
It's right.
Like, I don't know why you would do that. So I suspect it is something that like that will be replaced with like more and more animation from the previous episodes, which is an awesome idea.
And it just gets you pumped watching it. Yeah. It's so, so good.
Yeah. Incredibly slick. The ending stuff, the ending theme and all that, and like the way they transition to like the next time preview and all that, like that stuff's awesome.
Yeah. And the ending song also is very good.
Yeah.
Lynn is just a great Persona singer.
She is, yeah.
Yeah.
I think they all are.
They all are.
Four of them.
Yes.
Yeah, and I do like the way that they switch main vocalists for each of the games so that they all have really distinct sounds to them. Yeah.
Speaking of distinct sounds to Persona.
Yeah.
Should we talk Persona 4 Dancing All Night?
I think so.
And a little bit of Persona 3 Dancing Moon Knight and a little bit of Persona 5 Dancing Star Knight.
Yes, I still have those pre-orders for the Japanese version down because they still have not talked about anything of the English versions.
I now have those pre-ordered as well.
Thomas.
From Japan.
Yeah, oh, Thomas. Thomas comes into my room the other day and is like, Jonathan, how do you pre-order from Japan? Like, what do you do with that?
Well, I know you order some movies and stuff from Japan.
I have done a lot.
Have experience.
Yes, but yeah, it's. I mean, you're buying a PS4 to play these.
I have now purchased a PS4.
You
I
have?
Found a good deal this past week.
I mean, there's other stuff to play on PS4. Clearly,
yeah,
there
are other games. God of War got like unbelievable reviews, so it's like there's other stuff to play on the horizon. Spider-Man, of course, as we've talked about.
I haven't played Horizon from last year.
That's a good game.
Yeah, and a lot of PS4s. I mean, obviously,
I want to play Persona 5 again at some point.
There you go.
Yeah, a PS4 is a good investment, obviously. Even if my PS4, we'll talk about it later. It's fucked. Whatever. Anyway, I'm getting. It's like late Xbox 360 territory for me now on my PS4.
It's like it's 5 years old, 5 or 6 years old at this point. So,
I guess, yeah. But I need to bop it with a hammer. Anyway, so Thomas, like, what was it like when you first played Persona 4 Dancing All Night? Was it like falling in love?
Well, I should say you were talking about. Well, just Persona in general, you for years have been talking to me about, and I always thought, it like, whatever, it's weird, I don't know why you like it. Then I played Persona 3, finally, and it was like, okay, that's one of the best games I've ever played, it's incredible. And I played Persona 5, which is incredible. I finally got around to Persona 4 The Golden, which you had loaned me a Vita for.
We talked about the Vita Adventures at length
you guys,
on this podcast.
Yeah, I listened to that episode, you guys talked about all that. And then I was like, you know what? At the end of Persona 4 Golden, it was like, I want to do more of this. Because I really like these characters. And you're like, well, there's this whole visual novel in this dancing game. And I was like, I like music. I should play the dancing game.
But you were also, it sounded like you were more excited for almost the visual novel component at first.
Because I was like, I want to hear like more of these characters.
Yeah.
And then what happened, Thomas?
Well, so I played through the whole visual novel. And that's on, like, I think easy difficulty. I don't know if you can change that, actually.
No, I don't think you can.
Which is too bad, because now I can't play it again.
You just hand the fucking control and hand it to somebody else. It's like, play the song and give back me what it's done. It's like, I can't look at this on easy.
So then I started doing the free dance and buying all the accessories. I started buying DLC, and one thing led to another, and I was playing on all-night difficulty and getting a King Crazy on every single song.
Yeah, that's what is King Crazy?
So King Crazy is the highest rank. It's the perfect score or perfect ranking, essentially, where you don't miss or get a good ranking on any of the notes. There are four note rankings. There's miss, good, which is basically you missed, but the game's nice about it. Then there's great, which is pretty close.
They really should change it from good to condescending.
Well, that's what it feels like when I get it good. It's like, oh,
yeah, if
that
you're
wasn't
playing,
good.
It's like, it says good on easy good. And medium. When you play it on all night, it should honestly switch to condescending. It's like, fuck you, game. I know I missed.
Like, you did hit a button. Yeah, so.
So there's good, and then what is it? Great and perfect?
Yeah, so great and perfect is what you want to go for. I'm now at the point with the high scores where if I get more than about three greats in a song, I consider it a failure.
So you get all perfects.
All perfects, because that's what the high scores are. And the other thing you have to do to get the highest score possible is you have to turn on certain modifiers.
Yeah.
Namely, there are two that sort of randomize where the notes come from. So if you play it without those on, it's a little easier. You're not skipping around from the top to the bottom as much. Not that you're moving your thumb very much anyway. It's like half an inch.
Yeah.
But it's a little less logical when you have those turned on. And then the big one is you can't see any of the notes.
Yeah, because isn't it basically like they appear right before they hit where they're supposed to hit?
That is one modifier
you
can
turn
on.
Okay, there's one above that?
The one that really gets your score higher is you just completely turn off the notes so you can't see them.
So the only way to do it is to memorize the notes.
Yes.
Well.
And in order to do that effectively, you get a capture card from when you guys did Let's Plays.
I had to give them our capture card.
And on top of that, because this is when I had to play a PSTV now, you also have to get an HDMI splitter that'll disable the HDCP protection on the Vita, or on the Vita TV, so that you can actually capture it. And then you record all of them, which is about 14 gigabytes worth of video at 720p, and you watch them over and over until you get really good at them, which allows you to practice and get better. And then for the ones that you don't completely memorize, you can kind of cheat and watch while you play.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh. Now we're unveiling the dark secrets.
It's still pretty impressive.
It's also cheating.
I'm 100% positive that all the other people on the leaderboards did the same thing.
Probably, fair enough.
All like number in the top five on every single song, and you wouldn't just do that nilly-willy.
Yeah.
Just my opinion, though. There are a few that I did legitimately memorize, and I'm proud of that. Maze of Life is one of them.
Okay.
And that was the first one I got the high score on.
You will never forget that. So let's break this down.
Here's the other thing I did when I was going through trying to get the high scores. I made a document for myself.
Thomas has now taken out his phone and is finding this document.
It has the top. I have to find it here. But it has the top. I made three scores and the specific score and how many great notes were gotten in that specific performance, so I know how many great notes I can get in order to beat it.
And that's for every song.
For every single song.
He basically has a spreadsheet for every song, ranking the different ranks and knowing which score he has to beat and how he has to beat it.
Right, so that way you know if, like, oh, fuck, this is my fourth grade on the song, might as well retry, right?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus
Christ. So I'm showing this to you guys now.
Oh my god.
Yeah, this is the lengths I went to because
it's like 20 pages.
I think I might be a little bit obsessive about this.
No, you think? Thomas, do you want me to tell you what my experience playing Persona 4 Dancing All Night? As someone who played it a lot more than Jonathan was.
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
So yeah, I, you know, obviously played the visual novel, had fun with that. Like, a quick Persona 5 the animation note, they do have a little cameo from the pop idol star.
I love that. Yes, she's singing Calistigia.
Yep, there you go.
They've done a couple of those in Persona 5 the animation. They also had a reference to Naoto. Like, they clearly put it in the Persona 4 3 universe.
Yeah, like, more explicitly than the game is. So yeah. So you play through that whole, you know, visual novel, had fun, enjoyed that. Lots of great hijinks with Nanako and everything. Good old time was had by all. And then I got into the, like, okay, time to play the free dance mode or whatever and, like go through these songs. And went through all of them on hard. And I think I did get a bunch of King Crazies on hard. It's like, this is fun. And then went to all night mode. And I did complete almost every, I think, like, the last DLC song is the one I never ended up finishing. It's like, ah, fuck this. I played a lot of the game at that point. It's like, this is a pain in the ass. It doesn't even have a good, like, dance to go with it. It's just like playing a fucking, like, trailer for the game. Like, I'm not gonna play the song like 100 times to try to, like, get good at it. So, but I did finish almost all the game on all night. Got a lot of good scores, and then I was like, I've spent probably like 30 hours playing this dancing game. It's time to put this down, move on with my life, and buy a Hatsune Miku Project Diva. You know, like, it's time to move on to a real fucking rhythm game.
Yeah, my experience, by the way, I've...
Yeah.
You calling this a not real rhythm
game. No, it's, I'm being facetious. Obviously, I spent a lot of time playing it as an awesome game. And just, I'm about to spend $100 on the two sequels.
Yeah.
You said you probably spent about 30 hours.
Yeah.
I have screenshots of all my high scores on the leaderboards. And in the top corner, for some reason, when you're looking at scores, it has your play clock.
Okay.
And so this was from a few weeks ago. It was 77 hours.
Man.
That's what it took me to beat Persona 4 the Golden.
Right.
It actually has exceeded my Persona 4 Golden clock now.
Nice.
Yeah, now it's up to 84 hours.
And this doesn't count all the time you spent just watching the videos
no,
of the song.
No, because the other thing that these games don't have is you have to play a song all the way through if there's one part you're struggling at that you want to get better at. But
right,
by recording them, then I can go back and play through certain sections many times.
That is something that is frustrating, that like there, because there are some rhythm games that do allow you to like split it out into sections and allow you to replay a section over and over.
Yeah.
I wish that they had that in Dancing All Night.
But to be clear, my experience with Dancing All Night was beating the visual novel. I did beat everything on hard. I think I saw one song in All Night difficulty.
It's a big jump in
hard difficulty. And screamed like a little girl and threw my Vita against the wall. Not really.
But you didn't break it.
No, I didn't break it.
That was me who did that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love Dancing All Night. I just play it a little more casually. This is... So, like, your setup is you're playing it on a PS TV.
Yep.
And that's on your 4K monitor. You've got your PS4 controller wired in for maximum, like... You know,
I know it's very predictable what the latency will be between the sound and the picture and the controller.
So you've got it plugged in. You've got a second monitor. I mean, your normal setup is you've got a 3-monitor setup on your desk for computer stuff. But you've got the second monitor with, like, videos and replays and stuff.
Yeah.
You got the headphone. Like, you are, like, wired in playing this game. It's a good question. Do you think you could do this well in it just playing on the Vita?
You know, for some of them, I did to get the high score because some of them are... programmed slightly differently, where the songs, to get the perfect notes, you have to play like a little earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, some of them I did do on the Vita without any of the recordings or anything.
Nice.
But that was probably like 3 or 4.
I played the whole game just on my Vita.
Yeah, I don't have a TV.
I prefer playing it on PlayStation TV now. Just that's, you know, I'm not much for portable gaming. I like it.
Yeah.
You know, when I need to, but usually I like sitting at my desk.
Yeah,
I can respect that.
Yeah. What's your favorite song or favorites out of the different ones? Like both in terms of the remix, but also like to play. Like, what are your worthiest foes?
Well, here's an interesting one: "Dazzling Smile," which is the closing song for Persona 4 Golden Animation.
Yeah. So good.
Yeah.
The version on the game is the version used in Episode 11 when the voice actress for Marie
Hanzo
sings.
Kana. Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't know there was a different version because I played this before I watched the Golden anime.
So we were waiting like 11 episodes to see it.
Yeah, I was really excited because I like it a lot. But that one is, you know, it doesn't have any dancing. It's playing over a Texas closing theme. But I really like that animation anyway. And that one's just fun to play. And speaking of worthy foes, this is one that I literally couldn't beat because the person who has the number one score, Shadow Gears, on the leaderboard.
Shadow Gears, we're calling you out.
That's Gears with a Z. He is the most worthy foe because he appears in the leaderboards a lot. But in this one, he had 0 great, 100% perfect notes. So at best, I could tie his score, and I didn't even wind up doing that. I think I got 3 greats on that one.
So he has the maximum possible score.
He has the maximum possible score for that specific song.
Fuck you, Shadow Gears.
No, he's cool. The guy who I wound up saying fuck you a lot to is Gamer of Time.
that makes sense, honestly.
However, he is the one. He only has number one on one song now, and that's the one where Teddy does Pursuing My True Self. I say that is the Shinichi Osawa remix.
Yeah, because there are three versions of that song.
There are two remixes.
Yeah.
There's the Atlas, I think, Kozuka.
Yeah.
Atlas Kozuka remix, yeah.
Yeah, that Chie dances to, and I worked hard to get number one on that one. Probably my favorite one to do is Maze of Life. I just think that's a really good song, and I really like the dance, and Chie is my favorite character, so I like doing dances with Murakami and Chie.
That's the right answer for Persona 4.
Yeah. Snowflakes is actually another one of my favorite songs. I really like that remix because I think it sort of keeps the spirit of the song pretty well. It's fun to do that dance. And
is that a Naoto song?
That is Yukiko.
Okay.
But the lyrics are expanded in that in a lot of these, but the ones specifically in that one, the last 3 sort of verses they add to that song are really great.
Yeah, they're good.
And I like that remix a lot.
We were on the. We had to do a long drive recently. Like, we went to a movie together that was further away, and we just had the soundtrack on in order, which I haven't done in a while. Just,
yeah.
It's such a good soundtrack.
It's really good. Yeah.
We're going to get two more of these, guys.
I'm so excited.
It's so exciting.
I mean, that's why you have to pre-order the double pack from Japan, because they just give you the soundtracks with them. Right, yeah, Thomas?
And they give you the PS4 digital version of Four Dancing.
Yep.
So, yeah.
It's Square Mania.
There's all kinds of stuff to look forward to.
Let's also be clear. You're so into this, you are also doing an online Japanese course to learn enough Japanese to, like, navigate.
That is not the only reason I'm doing it. It's just a happy benefit.
It's a catalyst, though, isn't it?
I think so. I think the Persona games in general have gotten me more interested in Japanese.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of my main gateways. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And here I am now.
Yeah.
Look at Sean. I aspire to Sean.
One day you will spend like 120 hours playing through a game in Japanese that you could have probably cleared in 100 hours, but you're like, fuck it, I'm going to play in Japanese to spite this guy because he can't play in Japanese.
Thanks. And then you know that you learned something too.
I learned a lot. Yes. Yeah. It's nice. It's a nice bit of faith. And then plus it'll, I think with Dancing Moon Knight and Dancing Star Knight, a lot of it should be katakana, so there's not, you know, you should be able to manage at playing those games.
Yeah, I can read all of that now.
Yes, and then obviously you can just see the notes. The notes are not in Japanese.
Yeah, I was going to say, also, frankly, most of the song titles are in English and written with Romaji, so...
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and I know, like, the ones that aren't are going to be Memories of You and Hoshino Bokura 2, whatever that one's called.
Hoshito Bokura 2.
Hoshito Bokura 2, yeah.
Well, it's not two.
Whatever. Yeah, whatever.
It's okay.
I tried to say fast.
It's a preposition. It's just not that preposition.
Well, prepositional particle, John.
Prepositional particle.
It's just a particle technically, but yeah.
Okay. You get what I mean.
You're right. Yes. I'm sorry. I apologize.
It's okay. We'll get into the weeds of Japanese grammar on another episode of the Weekly Stuff podcast when you're a little bit further along in your study.
That sounds great. The other thing, since we're talking about 3 and 5 now, the Atlas YouTube channel recently posted the opening videos to those two games.
Yeah, I haven't watched them yet because I almost don't know if I want to watch them before I get the game. So that's where I'm. If I'm going to spend $100 on importing these games, do I really want to spoil the opening?
I have neglected to listen to most of the remixes other than the theme songs just because I was interested and I couldn't resist. The opening video for 3, without spoiling anything, is incredible. It's great. I love the song. I love the video.
Are they original songs for both of them?
Yes. It's like dance.
Yeah.
But
it's got a piece of the theme, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's like a minute and a half of the theme is the opening song or the opening movie.
No, but I was going to say it incorporates pieces of like Burn My Dread or...
Yeah, it's like in the same style of those, the way the dance was for Pursuit Yourself.
The opening video and corresponding song for Dancing Star Knight, Persona 5, is so good.
It will blow your fucking mind.
I cannot contain my excitement for these games. Sort of, you were saying, like, you haven't been really excited about a game like you are for the new Spider-Man in a long time. That's me with these two. And I just started playing Persona, like, a year ago, so I don't know exactly how that happened, but...
You're still in the honeymoon phase.
You're rocketing through it. It's an interesting time for you. I mean, honestly, for me, the thing with Moon Knight and Star Knight is I am really excited. I just keep on forgetting, because it's like... it's a weird thing... That when you get, like, kind of fairly bilingual, like, I'm not fully fluent in Japanese, but, like, I'm enough that I, like, engage with a lot of Japanese media without having to have, like, that filter, you know, of, like, having to have English subtitles and stuff like that. And it's like you have two different rooms that's, like, in your brain that's, like, this is, most of my life is spent in the English room. And then sometimes I'm in the Japanese room where I'm, like, watching... Let's say a video on the Japanese Nintendo YouTube channel where two middle-aged Japanese comedians play through the opening level of Donkey Kong Tropical Freeze on the Switch. That maybe happened yesterday. I don't know. Obviously, that doesn't have any subtitles, and I'm just watching it in Japanese, and it's like, when you're like in that mind space, it's like, it's totally different. And so that's where Dancing Moon Knight and Dancing Star Knight only exist in that part of my brain. And so when I'm going through my normal life, it's like, those games aren't real. They're not coming out. And it's like, I'm thinking about something in Japanese. It's like, fuck, those games are out in like a month.
All I'm thinking about is that I'm probably going to buy both of those games twice.
I can handle the English version.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll get those.
I think I'll rest at just getting the Japanese versions because I can't. No, I'm already spending extra in a couple of ways because the games are already more expensive in Japanese. You know, like the conversion rate and everything. And just like the way that they price games in Japan, they're more expensive than they are relatively over here. And I'm getting like the double pack that has all the extra shit. It's a lot.
Yeah, no. Even, I mean, I mean, I don't. You also probably wouldn't need the English versions, other than for little, like if you wanted to hear dub elements. Yeah. But I could lend you those when I get them or something. But like, because I'm in a weird place where like I will probably play around with it a little bit when you get them, Thomas. But I'm also like, there are so many fucking games in the world.
Yeah.
I'm also like perfectly happy to wait until they get their English versions, and I will just happily play them when they're here. And but yeah, it's gonna be. I will listen to the soundtracks on repeat.
My thought is, if they do announce that they're going to bring them to the West before May, whenever they ship.
Yeah.
It's the 25th they come out. I don't know when that pre-order will actually ship.
It'll be here on May 25th because Amazon Japan ships ridiculously fast.
It's true.
Anyway, if they do announce that before, then I'll probably cancel the pre-order. I will probably still get at least 5 Dancing Star Night digitally, if I can.
Just to play something?
Just to play one of them.
Like, for me, it honestly, what it goes to, and it's something that I'm so fucked, because I'm sure that even if they, like, announce that you're going to get, like, all the extras and everything with the English versions, the reason why I need to get the Japanese versions is because I'm so used to the Japanese voices for Persona 5. Like, I'm fine with the English voices for Persona 3. I just, you know, I've played 200 fucking hours of Persona 5 in the Japanese version and the English version. I tried to play the English version with the English dub, and it's like, I can't do it. Like, they're fine performances. I just can't switch to those other voices. That's like, I can't do it. Yeah. So it's like, I need the Japanese version, and I have no idea. Even if they do announce the English versions, I think there'll be a while before we are certain whether it would have the English dubs. Or the English dub and the Japanese version as well. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm fucked. I'm fucked.
Yeah. You're fucked. You're going to have to play a game you really want to play. It sucks.
I'm going to have to spend a lot of money. This is the part where I'm fucked. It's like, I'm going to end up wasting like $20 or something that I could have saved.
It's probably worth it, Sean.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Man, but there's a lot of Persona goodness coming out. I mean, we're also going to get Q2 at some point this year. Persona Q, whatever they're going to call it. You know, Shadow of Another Labyrinth. I don't know how that one's going to go. But you haven't played Persona Q. Neither of you have played Persona Q.
Should. Don't have a 3DS.
Sean, you got these... you're spending 80 hours on a train every day. You still won't get a 3DS.
I wouldn't play the 3DS on the train regardless. I don't like portable gaming. Like, it's just something I've never... Portable gaming has two uses. You play it in your bed. You play it when you're at your brother's basketball game and your fucking games get stolen. Those are the two times in my life.
It's probably
traumatic. And it's like... I can't truck with it. I like reading on the train, and I like making ranked lists of Spider-Man video games on a train, and that's my pastime.
That's a much more boring Samuel L. Jackson movie. Ranked lists of Spider-Man video games on a train.
Well, yeah, like that's where like Samuel Jackson gets on the train. It's like, you gotta get these motherfucking ranked Spider-Man lists off my motherfucking train. It's like, I'm sorry, Mr. Jackson. It's just, you know, we're recording a podcast. It's a whole thing. I played 9 of these games. I didn't even realize it.
All right. Any other Persona 4, 5, 3 dancing-related things to talk about while we're just here celebrating Persona? You're playing Persona 3 again right now.
I am.
Jesus Christ, Thomas.
You're doing a new game plus.
I need to play at least 3 and 5 again, just because I sort of want to wrap my head around them a little more. I might play 4 again while I'm at it, but...
You're stepping into territory that somehow I have never managed to do, which is do an actual New Game Plus of any of them, because new versions keep on fucking coming out.
That's true.
And I play the new versions, or the same version in a different language comes out, and I play that.
When the new version is 11 years old, though, it's easier to go back.
It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, anything else, guys?
I'm curious, like, thinking of the Persona 5 dub stuff, because how did... Because, Jonathan, you played through Persona 5 in English... Thomas, what did you do with like the English?
I played
English
it in English. English yeah, I played it. Like, I really like the English cast.
Yeah, like it's one of again, the better... yeah, me not playing it in English is not anything about that cast. It's just what I was used to.
Yeah, yeah.
But how did you feel about the Japanese voices and the animation then? Like, I'm just curious what your impressions were for those.
Oh, they're good. They're really. I mean, I watched the Persona 3 movies in Japanese, and the,
Four of the Golden
is only Japanese as well. So, I mean, I am probably more attached to the English voices, and it'd be weird to play them in the game that way, but I think just watching it, it doesn't weird me out, and I can better appreciate the great acting going on.
Yeah.
It's my favorite part of watching the animation so far. Same with the Persona 3 movies or something. It's just, for me, it's very fun to get to see the Japanese voices.
Persona 3 also had some voices in English that weren't good.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, there were some growing pains with that one.
For Persona 3 and 4, the games, you over here can't play them in Japanese, so the animation was the first time for us you got to see them that way. Mm-hmm. For Persona 5, we've had the option, and if I played the game again, I don't know, it's tough, because the English voices are so... And I know them so well, right?
Yeah.
But no, for the anime, I'm loving it. I mean, I'm really excited to hear more from Morgana, because she's so good.
You got a little bit of the taste of Morgana, and, like, Morgana was the character that I couldn't adjust to, because, like, that voice is so distinctive to me in Japanese. I love that performance so much.
Yeah. Although, I will say, I think Cassandra Lee Morris is as close as you can get with an English speaker to a dead ringer for Pikachu Lady, whatever her name is.
Yeah.
I'm forgetting. Sorry. You're a great actress beyond just Pikachu. I know that's like your simplest role, but yes.
She has found a lot of depth in uttering the name Pikachu.
Oh, she has. No doubt about it. She is a pro, and great as Morgana. The best thing, though, is Japanese Igor is the best thing that has ever happened to the world of acting.
Japanese Igor in 5.
In 5, yes. I mean, Japanese Igor in the other ones is great, too.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, that voice is deeper than a voice should possibly be able to be.
Yeah, it's good. You also get Japanese Sojiro also has a great, deep,
he's great.
Creamy... I could just listen to that dude's voice forever. He's in a bunch of stuff, obviously, but there's something about his... Like, what he gets into with Sojiro is like, I love this, like, really, like, sort of charismatic guy who just doesn't give a shit and he's not even trying to be charismatic. He's just like... He's the coolest dude on the planet. He doesn't give a fuck about you.
We also got... I'm going to tread lightly here for spoiler's sake.
Yeah.
We got one line from the main villain of Persona 5. The main human villain.
Yes.
Who you have told me a lot about. He's from Gundam.
Yes.
Great voice.
Yes, the character voiced by the guy who voiced Char from Mobile Suit Gundam. Yeah.
And I can already tell, like, I am going to squeal in delight when he gets real stuff to do. I am so excited.
That is the thing I'm honestly most excited for in Persona 4 the animation, is seeing how that boss fight is going to be rendered with that character, that actor, and everything. It's so good.
A lot of good stuff to look forward to. All right, well, we will be back next week. We will talk all sorts of stuff. I'm not sure what, but we've got a lot on the docket.
And, we've got some Doctor Who classic stuff we need to finish up.
Yep.
We've got a mission we need to complete.
Indeed.
Yeah.
All right, Thomas, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
it's nice to be able to talk about something really nerdy with people who know what I'm talking about.
Yes. You're able to unleash the floodgates of the 70-plus hours you've spent mastering, and that I think I used that verb correctly, mastering Persona 4 Dancing All Night.
Yes, when you're at the point where literally the only option is I have to do it perfectly.
or get defeated by, like, Shadow Gamers or whatever the fuck.
Shadow Gears.
Yeah.
Alright, well, you guys, we'll see you next week.
I'm so excited to see what you do with Star Knight and Moon Knight, Thomas. It's going to be fantastic.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
I can't let you have the last word.